what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the show. It's the Jeff Gerstmann Show. But still, that is still the name of this. That is still the name of this program until further notice. You know, all the trademark searching, all the, you know, it's like, turns out you can't just name, you can't go say, I want to have a new website and a new podcast and I want to call the website bing.com. They're like, no, someone is using that. And I'm like, for what? No one, come on. They're not using it for anything real. Let me do it. I want to rename this. This is the Bing. Welcome to the Bing cast. We're doing hella bingers. No, what's even going on? I'm Jeff Gerstmann. Daddy needs his juice. Daddy needs his. We're just gonna get into this. It's been a crazy morning. I got people in the house, so if you're watching the video version of this, you might see some folks coming in and out of the room. The carpet is peeled back because the carpet padding is finally going back in, and all this other stuff. So we're kind of on the next step of getting this room back together. And then there's another gentleman here doing some baby proofing and putting up some new gates because my son crawls real fast now, real fast. For a while, he was just doing the army crawl thing, and then I'm going to say over the last 2 weeks, he's been like, oh, I can use my hands for this, and now he's just like, plap, 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 and he is everywhere all at once. And so, not a moment too soon. We've had this booked for a little while to have this gentleman come in and put up some new gates. We already had some gates at the top and the bottom of the stairs in the home, the staircase, and you know, that's worked out up to a point, but, you know, there's a weird step down into the living room that my daughter already fell off of and hit her mouth very hard. We had to go to the dentist. It was traumatic for everyone involved. She has bounced back from that incredibly well, and is doing fine. But my son is now trying to test that ledge, and he's like, what if I rolled off of this thing? Yeah, so it has been absolute chaos around here this morning with all of that stuff. So that's very exciting. I don't think you'll hear any of it. Right before the show started, I realized, like, oh right, there's like a noise. I rigged up NVIDIA Broadcast with its like noise filtering stuff, and so what you are hearing live, at least, is the filtered end of that, and so that's pretty sweet. And we'll see how that all goes. And this is now like 20 minutes after someone said it in the chat, so it's not funny anymore. But I do have that hot Triple H sample. So yeah. That's what's been going on over here. You know, my wife and the kids took off for a few days, but they're coming back today because the place they went to stay ended up being not a great. My kids don't sleep anywhere but here, it turns out. And I know this. And I know going into like that they're just they don't like to sleep anywhere but here. So kids are coming back. Anyway, I've got this. Why don't we crack this open and find out about this and see what's up. I went to the gas station yesterday. I had to buy some windshield wiper fluid and also some windshield wiper fluid for my insides. This Black Cherry Vanilla Bang. So why don't we try this out here? I know they had some kind of, well, I don't know that I've had the Black Cherry Vanilla before, but smells okay. Smells all right. Oh yeah, that's pretty good. That's not bad. You could drink these. You could. As bangs go, I'm going to say it's a pretty good one. Yeah, not bad. Maybe we'll put that on the ranking list maybe a little later in the show. So yeah, what's going on? Video games, that's what's going on. They're back. John Madden football came out, and you know, that's the Groundhog Day equivalent of video games, right? Not so much this year, right? I mean, so it used to be, and you know, I guess this is just a natural thing. It's like a normal thing, but you know, if you haven't been like kind of immersed in video game coverage or whatever for, you know, multiple decades, maybe it doesn't feel this way anymore, but the release of John Madden Football was always the thing that signaled, okay, summer's over, it's time for video games to come out again. And so those slow summers would fall away, and then a bunch of other stuff would immediately start coming out. And it feels like, well, I mean, what, like Saints Row is kind of the only thing. What is a big game anymore, right? I guess that's the other thing that's changed is, you know, how many companies are out there shipping big old now $70 games in some cases for consoles. It's way fewer than we used to get in years past. And so Saints Row is kind of the only other thing. It sounds like that there are some incredible, yeah, no, but the other big games, Pac-Man World Repack, of course, which we'll talk about in a moment here. But it looks like I've seen some amazing videos of Madden this year that look incredibly, like it just looks super fucking broken, which is pretty awesome. As a fan of videos of broken video games, right? If I was a fan of football video games, I would probably be pretty bummed out that the only game out there sucked. I don't know that it necessarily sucks. I haven't really seen people, you know, when the game is working as intended. I don't know if does people like it or not. I don't know, but I've seen some incredible bug videos, and that's pretty awesome. The couple of people I've heard talking about it have said, hey, this seems like a pretty whack version of the game this year. So I don't know, but I don't play it for myself, so I don't know. I did install it, and actually I thought that the little intro game that they had, the intro thing they do between like old Madden and new Madden and that sort of stuff, I thought was pretty exciting. I think that's kind of a cool thing to do. It's an interesting way to honor Madden. You know, he passed away since the last game came out and all that sort of stuff, and you know, that's, you know, so it's a weird thing of where they're gonna like try to figure out a way to honor Madden in this thing that is kind of, you know, that they've kind of exploited stuff with him over the years, and so it is this weird like commercial product that is doing this. But at the same time, I don't know, I thought they did a nice job of kind of honoring Madden in that context, if that makes any sense, and trying to find ways to be like, hey, you know, the namesake of this video game has passed away, and what does that mean? And so for them it means like, hey, we put Madden on the cover this year, finally, in the, like the regular version of the game, not just the like, hey, you bought the expensive version or whatever. And so I don't know. I think that's, it feels nice. It feels right. All that sort of stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I've seen like a lot of people complaining like, oh, they're exploiting Madden. But it was like, they've been exploiting Madden for decades. That's the nature of the deal they signed. It's not, you know, They paid him quite well for that, I'm sure, and he gained a very large level of fame, additional fame to additional generations and all that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I thought it was nice. I thought that the little introductory game, because they fill it full of all of these, you know, nuggets on commentary of kind of talking about John Madden and all this other stuff. And you know, I ended up talking about it when he did pass away, but you know, it's really neat. I don't know, like John Madden as this mythical figure that is so much bigger than football because of how major of a figure he has been in video games. Like, I think even if you don't care about football or care about the Madden franchise as a video game, like, he's still been this constant and been this kind of ongoing thing. Anyway, I thought that a little introductory game was pretty cool, and then I uninstalled the game because I just didn't. I don't want to play a proper football video game. I just never have. But anyway, it used to be when those games would come out, it was a big deal. EA would put on these massive events. I think the biggest one they did that I can remember is they had Ozzy Osbourne performing on the top of I want to say it's the Ed Sullivan Theater, but it was a theater like in or near Times Square in New York. And they put on this, it was a bit, you know, one of their big midnight launch things and all this other stuff. And it's such an excessive, like you think about it now, you think about how video games launch today. And it just feels like such an insane, excessive thing, that whole concept of the midnight launch. And now, you know, like you click three buttons on your console and then at 9 o'clock Pacific time, the game unlocks and you're like, great, awesome. Now I can play it or whatever. And I think that is an improvement, generally speaking, you know, but there is a shrinking amount of pomp and circumstance in the release of video games. And maybe it's just like that with everything now, right? I mean, when it comes to music releases and all of that sort of stuff, it just feels like that there's, you don't have the big, oh my God, this new thing just came out. Like that whole shared experience, that whole, like we made a big deal, and that's probably fine because like at the end of the day, it's all that shit is just marketing, like who cares. But I don't know, these things, the way E3 used to be, like all of that other stuff contributed to, I think, video games feeling like a much bigger thing and a much larger like cultural event, and that just feels like it's gone now. And so along with that, I think, you know, the way that video games used to kind of quote unquote come back after Madden was released, you know, and we would get through the summer and then we would start the run up to the holiday season. And so you would hit September, you would hit, you know, mid August, whatever it was, Madden would ship. And then for me as a reviewer, I would be like buckling in going like, all right, fuck, get ready, 'cause every game in the world's about to come out over the next, 3 months, and we're going to review them all. And so it was really a signal of just like, okay, this is when it's going to get nuts. It's not like that anymore. You know, it was kind of nice. Like it actually was weirdly nice having Saints Row come out recently, 'cause it almost felt like this weird throwback of like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that kind of like late August, early September release around the Madden launch and all that other stuff. Like it was weirdly nostalgic. Unfortunately, Saints Row was horrifically, they've patched it. They actually did issue a patch, and I have not tried it since the patch came out, but the patch notes don't say much about, hey, there are missions in this game that are straight up broken, and there's a game, you know, massive game breaking issues that you might just run into at random across multiple missions in this game. It was more like, oh, if you're running the DX12 version, it'll run better. And so I don't think they actually, like, they're billing it as a hot fix. I don't even, they're not even necessarily saying like, here's this big old patch. But we talked about Saints Row last week, so I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it other than to say I finished it. There's a video up on YouTube about it if you want to see, if you want to see me playing the game kind of post credits and talking about it. I ended up spending a lot of time talking about Saints Row there. So the only thing I'll kind of say here on the podcast to kind of wrap that back around is everything I said about the game last week holds up. I have since finished the game and rolled credits on it and all that sort of stuff. And, I think that game is really empty from a story perspective. And I think that it's a shame because there's like a promising setup with like potentially interesting new characters and all that sort of stuff. But they just don't do anything with that. And that stuff's pretty rotten. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that Saints Row is that game. And it's just, here's a very standard, you know, open world driving game across the board. It's an incredible disappointment. And I wish that game, that was one of my high hopes, was like, man, Saints Row, what's Saints Row going to be? Because they're going to reboot it. That's so smart because it has to be rebooted. Toss out all those characters. All that stuff is so old. Like, there's just a smarter, you know, there's like, I think attacking it from a new angle could be a whole lot of fun. And finding out what do you do, like the origin story of a gang, all that other stuff, I think has a lot of promise. But I don't think they found anything in there, both from a story perspective and from a gameplay perspective. It just feels like, you know, it feels like a GTA knockoff, which is maybe the worst thing you can say about it, because Saints Row 3 and 4 feels like it transcended that label, you know, after a lot of years of, you know, of Saints Row 1 and 2 existing as just like, Saints Row 1 had multiplayer before GTA did, and Saints Row 2, some people like for whatever reason, and all that sort of stuff. Like Saints Row the Third felt like it finally got away from that label and finally became its own thing. And this feels like such a step backwards in so many different ways. Not that they, but again, like it's a hard problem to solve. Yes, I'm sorry. I've talked about this over and over again because it's just such a fascinating. It just feels like such a difficult problem to solve in terms of what the hell do you do to reboot Saints Row while also making sure that you don't just make it another like GTA knockoff, like going back to basics in that way just seems like a super negative thing. And so, you know, that's a very hard problem to solve. And I think it's, I guess at the end of the day, it's not too surprising that they did not solve that problem. And as I thought about it more and more, kind of the last thing I'll say about goddamn Saints Row, I don't want to fucking talk about Saints Row anymore. We've spent so many hours talking about this goddamn game. But the last thing I'll say about it is that in a world where there are not very many GTA knockoffs anymore, remember, like, you know, through the PS2, PS3 era, like those generations, you know, you ended up with stuff like Scarface and what else, you know, the Mafia games to a certain degree, just all of these other games, True Crime, Sleeping Dogs, like, you know, the list of games that were trying to be GTA. Godfather, you know, all of 187 Ride or Die, you know, the hits. So many different games were trying to be that, and now that doesn't exist anymore. You don't have the abundance of GTA knockoffs that are like, hey, what if we took Grand Theft Auto but we did this, or what if we set it here, or what if Snoop Dogg was in it, you know, like all that shit. And so in a world where those games don't exist, like Saints Row is unique in a sense where it's like, oh, they don't make these back to basics GTA-ass GTA games anymore. Even GTA is trying to be something higher minded than it used to be, you know, whether you like it or not, they're trying to do it. And so in that specific world, all these years removed from it, is there just a new generation of players out there who don't remember all of the fucking shitty GTA knockoffs? And are those players like kind of psyched? They're like, oh, well, it's another one of those. That's cool. There aren't any more of these. And GTA 5 is old now. So it's nice to have, like, is there some audience that is at least like open to that in a way that me, someone who has played all of those games and is done with them, it's just like, I'm not here for another weird GTA knockoff, especially one that's not weird enough. It's honestly like just not that weird. The biggest sin, the biggest curse, the biggest problem. I hate using the word sin. It has just terrible connotations. Those fucking cinema sins weirdos. You know, the biggest problem that Saints Row has is that it's incredibly dull. You know, they'll eventually patch it up. They'll eventually fix it up. They'll eventually get but you have to assume that the technical end of that game gets improved to the point where it's just, it works, right? It works as intended. The problem is, as intended is still not a very good game. Okay. Let's just put a bow on, let's agree to just maybe not talk about Saints Row anymore. It's just not that interesting of a game at the end of the day. And that's its real problem. Let's take a quick break for an ad, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to talk to you about my safe cracking adventure and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collection and some other stuff that came out this week. And and Agents of Mayhem 2. Exactly, of course. That's what else could we be possibly going for in this day and age, right? Like, of course, that's what's next. Hey, listen, I'm a couple of drinks in right now. You know, it's a nice a Monday night. I got a podcast in the morning, but you know, my wife's out of town, the kids are out of town, I got the house all to myself. I'm like, what if I had a couple of beers? That might be nice. Ugh, but I gotta stay up late. I gotta do this podcast in the morning. I can't afford it. So hey, ZBiotics. Is that the solution? That's the solution. ZBiotics, what is it? ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. It's designed to work like your liver, but in your gut, where you need it most. Just remember to drink ZBiotics before drinking alcohol, drink responsibly, and get a good night's sleep to feel your best tomorrow. The ZBiotics product, it's a tiny little shot, smaller than a shot, probably, even if I'm not counting, but you know, you just throw that back, tastes fine, goes right down, and you know, you have your drinks, you know, maybe don't go crazy. You know, try to drink a little water while you're at it. Do the right thing along the way, and then wake up feeling fine. That's my big plan right now, is that I will wake up feeling fine and, you know, do a live podcast in the morning wherein you will hear this advertisement. In fact, it's crazy. Hey, now you can give ZBiotics a try for yourself. Go to ZBiotics.com/Jeff to get 15% off your first order when you use the code Jeff at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they will refund your money. No questions asked. And hey, I don't know if you've been online lately, but it's true. Halloween is right around the corner. So get yourself a pack of ZBiotics for you and your friends today to make sure you get it in time for candy and cocktails. Remember, head to ZBiotics.com/Jeff and use the code Jeff at checkout for 15% off. And thanks to ZBiotics for sponsoring this episode. All right, we're back. Let's talk about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Have you heard of these guys? Seriously, they're turtles. They live underground in the sewers. And they're ninjas. They were taught by a rat how to fight. That's pretty much it. Wait, hang on. No, the Teenage Mutant, the Cowabunga collection. God, am I getting the name of that right? I had the name right in front of me, and then I closed that tab. Yes, I'm sorry. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Cowabunga collection is the full name of this collection. It's weird. There are a lot of games in this collection, and it is a well-realized collection with a bunch of fun little snippets of, like, behind this, like, design docs. There's a press release for one of the games in there that you can look at, and those extras are interesting. And it's a bunch of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles games. The catch is, I don't think many of these games are any good at all. So let's run down the list here. In this collection, you will find Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the arcade game. Now, that is the four-player Konami thing. You will find Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time, the arcade game. Great game. These games are, you know, these are the games that you get and finish in 20 minutes, and maybe you play them again, all that sort of stuff. That's cool. You will get the NES version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was that game that had the top-down perspective and then the side-scrolling, like you would drive around in the van up on the city streets and then go underground and there'd be side-scrollers there. And that game straight up sucks. You also get the NES version of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, the arcade game, which is a port of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the arcade game. But they called it 2 because they had already made a 1 at home. It's a decent port, again, on a collection. So it's like, it's nice to have, right? We're like, oh, that's a lot of the games on this collection. You go like, that's cool that that's here. I'm going to look at it for like 5 minutes, like, because the NES version of TMNT, the arcade game, like, whatever. It's you're not going to want to play it. Also, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, The Manhattan Project for NES. On the list of games provided on the Steam page, it just has the letter N. Like a little, you know, they should just put a winky face next to it. Like, it's N. Blink, blink, blink. We're not going to say what the N means. You will also get Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters for the N. I don't know that I even knew that that version of the game existed. I thought that Tournament Fighters was a 16-bit game. You will also get, and the numbering, it's always funny to remember the numbering on these games. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4. Turtles in Time, aka the second Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles arcade game. But on the SNES, they labeled it 4. That's for the SN. Hmm? Huh? The old SN? You like that SN? You will also get Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters for the SNES. That's that fighting game. It's neat. And the game, this collection does have online support. So theoretically, they are selling you Tournament Fighters with online support, which is a cool idea. It has settings for frame delay and stuff when you're creating a lobby and all that sort of stuff. I have not tried any of the online yet because the game just came out this morning. I fired it up last night and was like, let's see, because I just figured for whatever reason that it was going to be out at 9 o'clock. And so I'm like, well, maybe there'll be some people playing Tournament Fighters, but no. So I will probably want to try that out. I'm not a huge Tournament Fighters fan, but it has its fans, and that's cool. You will get also, there's more. There are a ton of games on this collection. It's kind of badass from that perspective. Like, you can't deny that they sure did put a lot of 8 and 16-bit Turtles games into this thing. And that's cool as shit. So, what else? Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Hyperstone Heist for the SG. What could the, I don't know, what is the SG? Who can say? You will also get Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters for the SG. And you will get, obviously that's the Genesis version of Tournament Fighters. I think the SNES version is the preferred version. Again, I was never been, yeah, it's the SG 1000. That's right, exactly. Sega's most classic of consoles. But wait, there's more. You will also get Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Fall of the Foot Clan for the Game Boy. I'm sorry, for the GB. Guard Bike, I think is what that means. Fall of the Foot Clan is a Game Boy game that I played a lot of. It's the first of the Turtles games to come to Game Boy. I don't think it's a very good game, but I sure did play the heck out of it. Because it was one of the 3 or 4 Game Boy games I owned at the time. It was like, what? It was like that, Mario Land, Motocross Maniacs, which is a world-class video game. Absolutely. Motocross Maniacs, an amazing product. I love it. And like Alleyway, maybe? I'm trying to remember what else I owned early Game Boy. But anyway, Fall of the Foot Clan, you walk to the right, you hit dudes, there's pizza. Which I guess is actually a running theme through almost all of these games, if we think about it. You walk to the right, and hit dudes, and there's pizza. And then there are two more Game Boy games here that I have no history with. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Back from the Sewers, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, Radical Rescue. That's a lot of Turtles games for the eight, you know, for Game Boy and NES and SNES and Genesis, and those two arcade games as well. So I think that's an awesome collection. I think on this list, Turtles and Turtles in Time are obviously the two great games here that you want to play. Those Konami side-scrolling beat-em-ups. The NES stuff is pretty rotten. You know, it's that port of Turtles in Time to SNES was pretty good, but it's like, again, on a collection that also has the arcade version, you're looking at it from like a completeness' sake. But it's awesome that it's there. But realistically, are you going to go play all like that stuff? Maybe not. Maybe not. And you know, stuff like Hyperstone Heist, like I don't have a ton of I don't have hugely fond memories of Hyperstone Heist. I don't know that I played too much of it. Again, Tournament Fighters was never my thing back in the day, so I don't have like a nostalgic attachment to it. It's neat that it's there. And so they've done well with this collection in a variety of ways. So they've got pretty decent behind the scenes stuff, but there's no video. I wish, and I, you know, maybe this is just impossible to get, or maybe they just didn't think that that people would be interested all that much in, you know, but all the design docs are in Japanese, and I didn't see a way to kind of translate those. So like, I, you know, it didn't seem like there was like English versions of that text. So you just kind of look at it and go like, okay, maybe there is something there that shows captions or something like that, but I didn't see that. Also, no videos. Someone in chat is saying there is a translate button, which, okay, I did show controls and didn't remember seeing it, but okay. If that's there, good. I want more video. I want interviews. I want interviews with the people that made these games talking about the making of those games. And you don't seem to be getting that here, which, you know, think about that Blizzard collection, and, you know, maybe that's just availability of the people who made these games originally. Maybe they just simply were not available and all that sort of stuff. But I would have liked to have seen some more, behind the scenes kind of interviews with the people who made the games. I don't care what Eastman and Laird have to say about it. They're like, yeah, we licensed it to Konami, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't give a shit what those guys would have to say about those games. Unless they were like deeply, deeply, deeply involved in their development, maybe, but I don't think that's the case. So yeah, I don't know. I want to see what this game looks like once it's out, because I want to see how the online stuff ends up faring, because when you go pick Tournament Fighters for the SNES, there's an extra options page that you can go look at. And from there, you can turn on the boss characters. Like, basically, the cheat codes you would be able to enter in the SNES version of that game are toggles here. So you can turn on, like, an extra speed setting, I think, extra stages, and the ability to play as, like, two boss characters, which is, like what? It's, like, Rat King and one other guy. And so being able to toggle that stuff on, I think, is really awesome. And you know, without having to enter the cheat codes and all that sort of stuff, I think that's pretty neat. So yeah, I don't know. It's a neat collection. I don't have I don't have a huge fondness for most of these games. So that's kind of where it falls apart for me. In fact, I would say I have like a negative, like the games on this list that I did play quite a lot of, I think are like actually quite bad, because it's the NES version of Turtles, like the first one, which I owned and played quite a bit of, and was like, I hate this game. Even then, I was like, everything about playing this game just sucks. But I'm going to play it anyway, because it's what I have in front of me. And then that Game Boy game I finished multiple times. And I went back and played some of that, and I was like, you know, this is not nearly as bad as I thought it would be. From my memory of what Fall of the Foot Clan was originally like on the Game Boy, I was like, yeah, you know, it's not great. It's a pretty standard side-scrolling game, and you hit them, and there's parking meters, and you hit those, and they go flying, but it's not a very dynamic game. And so it's a little bland, but that said, I think that they've really done right by this collection with what they had to work with. And, you know, it's, you see hints of it and you're like, yeah, I mean, people did some digging here because there's a press release for one of these games. Like, you don't see a lot of press releases for, I believe it's for one of the NES games. And I just don't think, you just don't see that sort of material showing up all that often anywhere these days. And so it's pretty awesome that that's in there. They've got like strategy guide stuff for some of the games in there as well, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of cool. It's really, I think it was written in the era, so it's a lot of like, radical dude, here's how you do, you know, like it is written from the Turtles' perspective. It is written in the Turtles' voice, let's say. And so it's a little grating. Speaking of grading, Pac-Man World Repack came out late last week. This is a re-release of Pac-Man World, which was a game that came out on the PlayStation 1 and I believe some other platforms. There was like a GBA port of it too. But it was referred to then as like Pac-Man World 20th anniversary. Like it was, you know, it came out in 2002, so that was technically the 20th anniversary of... No, I'm sorry. That's right, right? 2002, because Pac-Man was 82? Anyway. No, Pac-Man was like 80. Anyway, they put it out as a 20th anniversary celebration of Pac-Man World. Okay, so it was not 2002, it was 99. Yeah, because you would not be putting out a PlayStation 1 game in 2002 when I think about it now. So, yes. More like a 2099, somewhere in that realm. Makes a lot more sense. And so this is a remake, a update. They made some relevant gameplay changes to it. You know, this is a re-release of Pac-Man World, which was a platformer, a 3D platformer, where you play as Pac-Man. And the ghosts kidnap your family, and you and there's a big robot Pac-Man called Talkman, like a clockwork Pac-Man called Talkman, T-O-C, like TikTok. And you have to collect the letters that spell Pac-Man. I streamed some of this last week. I went into this stream last week in a pretty good mood. I was like, yeah, man, let's play some video games. Let's fucking... Oh, yeah, Talkman. It's Namcot spelled backwards. That makes sense. But I went into that stream going like, yeah, you know, we'll play some games. Let's play some stuff. We'll do some Destiny. What else? I got this Pac-Man World reinstalled. Let's do that and check that out. And then I fired that up, and I don't think that game is necessarily like... something about that game robbed me of my will to live, and I can't really explain to you why. It is, it's 3D platformer, but you don't have camera control, and so it's, you know, which is, that is faithful to the PlayStation 1 original version of the game. Like, the game kind of all happens in front of you. You are sort of moving to the side and all that sort of stuff, and you are encountering ghosts and making rows of dots appear, and then you're doing a little bit of Pac-Man-esque stuff in there. One of the changes they made is when you eat a power pellet in this game, you become gigantic, like a Super Pac-Man-esque giant Super Pac-Man. You did not do that in the original PS1 version of the game, which is crazy. So big changes. But this kind of, it's not quite a collectathon, but you are collecting items in each level, and you are expected to spell Pac-Man by collecting the letters of Pac-Man in that level and all that sort of stuff. And there are objects that sometimes don't respawn that mean if you were to break a barrel that you needed to bounce off of to get up to where the N is, you might get through 90% of the level doing just fine, and then suddenly, oh, I guess I can't collect this N because I broke this barrel, and oh, I'm gonna die, and oh, the barrel didn't respawn when I died, and so I guess I have to play this entire level over again if I want to spell Pac-Man, and that's a bad feeling. It made for bad feeling. How about that? And yeah, I don't know. Like they made adjustments to this version, this re-release of the game. Some of them for legal reasons. They have replaced Ms. Pac-Man with the Pac-Mom character that you've seen in some of the more recent re-released stuff, since Namco continues to be so stubborn so as to not pony up for the rights to Ms. Pac-Man, which is an insane turn of events, a really ridiculous situation, but you know, what are you going to do? I don't think that game is I don't think that very, yeah, I don't think the game is very good. Also, yes, I kind of can't blame Namco for if At Games is the company that is trying to extort Ms. Pac-Man to you. I think at some point you got to be like, oh yeah, we are not giving those people any money. All those bad releases they made over the years, they don't deserve it. But somehow they ended up with the rights to Ms. Pac-Man, which is a damn shame. It's just a really strange product. You know, Namco put those Klonoa games out again recently, and that was pretty awesome to see. And then, yeah, at some point they said, like, we're putting out Pac-Man World. And you're like, okay, it's been like over 20 years since this game came out. Like, it's not like this style of platformer is suddenly back in vogue, and they're like, everyone's going to love this. It's a really strange choice for a re-release to begin with. And yeah, because I remember the time that game coming out and being like, all right, yeah, I guess everyone needs to make a 3D platformer now, kind of in this post. Well, I guess that was 99, 2000. Like through that whole generation, we were seeing kind of the fallout, the kind of ongoing effects of, you know, the upgrade in technology to allow for all these 3D games. And then, you know, the popularity of Mario 64 and the games that kind of came after, in the wake of that game, or you know, around that as contemporary, whether it was Croc or Glover or whatever the hell else was coming along. You know, there were a lot of highly questionable platformers coming out around that time. You know, even something like Crash Bandicoot kind of falls into that realm, right? I think, you know, Crash kind of got out of it by finding some interesting ways to pull stuff off. But yeah, the later Gex games, I don't know that I would put Bug in that. Well, you know, Bug is not a fully 3D platformer, but neither is Pac-Man World. So maybe that's a perfect fit in a lot of ways. Just a really weird release. And from playing it, they redid the, you know, they went in and re-recorded the music, but kept some of the same themes. So someone on the Discord posted, where did that go? Well, maybe it's for the best that I can't find where the Pac-Man World music was posted, because none of us need to hear that right now. None of us need that. But they did. They updated the tunes and put it back out and did like a surprising amount of work to it in terms of, you know, like even just like rebalancing it a little bit and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, adding moves, you know, making giant Pac-Man, redoing all of the cutscenes to make them much more elaborate, all of that sort of stuff. It's a lot of work. A lot more work went into Pac-Man World Repack than you might expect. And that's weird. I don't know if that's weird. Like, I don't know. But that, something about playing that game robbed me of my will. Yeah, robbed me of my will to live a little bit. It's just like, God, I don't know why. I don't know why, but something about that game really bummed me out. I think maybe it's just like I didn't eat lunch or something like that, and just the bottom dropped out. But it was just something about playing that game made me just feel real rotten. You know what made me feel real good, though? And you know what game is continuing to make me feel real good? Is Arcade Paradise. It's out on Steam. It's out on consoles. Some consoles. I'm not sure which. All of them? I don't know. Again, Arcade Paradise is a game where you start out by opening a laundromat, and you are doing a lot of laundry, and there's a couple of arcade games in the back room, and over time, you start to expand your building to have more room for more arcade machines. And so you're saving up money to buy new arcade machines, while also eventually getting upgrades and getting a jukebox and having music that plays in your back room arcade. And I finally hit this tipping point where I finally realized, you know what? I'm just not going to do the laundry anymore. I'm making enough money off the arcade machines, and I need to get upgrade currency to buy the kind of character upgrades that now I'm just not going to waste a bunch of time doing laundry. And so it's such a fascinating pastiche of games and music from across different eras. Like, it's not, they are not nailing down to a specific year. Like, you could find years on calendars and be like, oh, it's supposed to be 93 or, you know, whatever. But like, the music crosses a lot of lines in terms of, like, some of it sounds a little more mid to late 90s. Some of it even starts to get in a rap rock direction, but maybe not really. But then you have kind of house music and a lot of early 90s stuff on that end. And so the soundtrack is really awesome in the context of the game. They'll sell you the soundtrack on Steam if you want it. And I grabbed it and started listening to it. And when you can hear it really clearly, the music loses a step a little bit, because a lot of the lyrics are about games in a way that I think comes off as super corny. But when you kind of hear it overall, you're like, oh, okay, this is a, you are trying to, you're making a Cypress Hill song. This is your song that is a pretty direct reference to A Tribe Called Quest. One of the fake bands is called the Grand Royalties. If you don't remember, Grand Royal was the Beastie Boys record label. And so that song has kind of an ill communication era, a check your head era kind of Beastie Boys track. And at first, like, I was listening to that and I was like, oh, look, it's like Kid Rock. It's like this realization of just like, well, yeah, I mean, Kid Rock was just ripping off the Beastie Boys anyway. He just took it in a somewhat harder direction. So I don't know. Anyway, the soundtrack's really fascinating. But like, you get these arcade machines, and they're fully playable, and you have goals to complete on each one. So basically, like, they've built achievements for these arcade machines along the way, and as you complete the goals, the machines will start to earn more money, and so you're incentivized to play the games and do well at them. Both because that's a way for you to earn the upgrade currency that you can use to buy things like, you know, the ability to run, or, you know, the ability to have your garbage bags hold twice as much garbage. So when you go to pick up garbage around the laundromat, you can hold more in your bags. You can hire an assistant that will go around and will empty the machines for you. I have not earned enough currency to buy a lot of the upgrades yet, but it's really fun. Even the early parts of that game where you are primarily just like moving laundry from washers to dryers and then like frantically trying to get in some time on the arcade machines and trying to balance all that stuff. I think even that aspect of the game where it's a little more hectic is really fun. But you eventually hit this tipping point, and I'm probably like, oh, what am I, like 15-ish, 10-ish, something like that, hours in. But you do eventually hit a tipping point where you're like, oh, the laundry stuff, I don't need to do it as much. I don't need to care about it as much because I have enough arcade machines that are earning enough money. And so that's funding me buying more arcade machines and the other expansions that you need to buy and all of that sort of stuff. And the arcade machines themselves are this really, again, like this really fascinating pastiche of games from across eras. So you've got games in there that have like vector graphics. You've got games in there that are just like incredibly simple, like bad mobile game, bad flash game, simple. But then you've also got like fairly elaborate, like clones of Mr. Driller. And like there's a pretty decent like driving game in there, like a futuristic kind of racing game. So this wide array of games, you eventually get a DDR machine. And the best part about these games, the best thing about these arcade machines that you unlock in Arcade Paradise, is that some of these games are bad, but they are bad in the way that old arcade games would sometimes be. And so it's this fascinating thing of like, well, I've got to blow up, you know, what is it? I don't know, 30 helicopters in this shitty vector graphics game. And I'm just going to knock this out and get it done. It's not a great game, but I'm going to still do this. And so you're fumbling with the controls because they're not great. And that's the thing is, like, you would run into like B and C tier arcade machines in the actual era, you know, in the actual early 80s that fucking sucked. And you would play them anyway because it was still new to your arcade. And you're like, well, maybe I just suck at it. And maybe I need to spend some more time. So it's kind of awesome in that weird way. Like, some of the games are legitimately fun. Some of them are not. But in some ways, the games that are fucked up and not fun are awesome in their own right. The one exception that I've encountered so far is the Dance Dance Revolution style game. It's got like three songs in it, and the step charts in it do not correspond to the music very well at all. And so it's not that it's a difficult game. You can still complete the achievements in it and do all that sort of stuff. But in context of like, some of these games are bad, but still fun in the way that they are bad, the DDR game actually just sucks. And it's a shame. It's a shame that that's not better. They should fix that to make those step charts line up to the music a little bit better. That would at least be, you know, more acceptable. I don't know. Like, it just, yeah. So that's been the one real disappointment in that game for me has been that, you know, you see the DDR machine, you're like, oh shit, I'm going to get a DDR machine. And then you're like, oh wait, I don't necessarily want to just play DDR on a gamepad. Anyway, I know that people are all into their Bemani games on a keyboard now, and that back in my day, we bought dance mats, is what I'm saying. You damn kids with your keyboard-based, Bemani ripoffs. No, thank you. I want to get up and move. I believe in miracles, is what I'm saying. Da 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 da. All of that stuff. But Arcade Paradise just continues to be an absolute delight. I'm having an awesome time with it, and I really want to unlock more of those machines. But I'm happy with the rate at which you unlock them, because the other thing that starts to happen is the last two arcade machines that I purchased, I started getting, you have a computer in your office and you use that to order new machines and do all this other stuff. I started getting emails on that computer from people that were attending my arcade, and they were like, hey, are you the owner of this arcade? I just got this high score on this machine. I bet you can't beat me. And then you're like, oh fuck, okay, I guess I now have another reason to go back and play what, like Wood Gal or whatever, which has the depth of a, it's actually like, it's kind of a knockoff of, what is it? It reminded me there's a log cutting game in Work Time Fun for the PSP that it sort of reminded me of, but the like climb the tree, there's something very specific that it is, and I just can't, I'm not pulling the name right now. I'm sorry. But you get an email saying like, oh, I just beat this score. I bet you can't beat it. And you're like, shit, okay, well, I'm going to go beat it. And then you go out there and you beat it, and then you immediately, like in an unrealistic way, honestly, it seems like that should wait a day before you get the next email. But you go beat it, and then you get another email from the person saying like, oh, wow, I can't believe you beat my score. Anyway, I just beat your score by another 7 points. You're like, shit, okay, well, I'm going to go back out there. Fuck these people. I'm going to go out there and beat that high score too. And so having weird high score challenges with fake people actually proves to be a good incentive to go back and play some of these more basic arcade games and get better at them. And it's nice because a lot of the games in there actually do have online leaderboards, and so you can go in there and see, you know, your Steam friends list, you know, the people on your Steam friends list and how well they're doing at those games, and so there's just like, that's fun too. Like they've made they've done a really good job at making good fake arcade games that kind of come with a lot of the warts and bumps of old arcade games, but then some of them go in a different direction. And so the game that's a Mr. Driller knockoff, like, you buy upgrades, you have persistent upgrades in that game, which for the idea of an arcade machine is absolute nonsense. Generally speaking, I know there were some arcade machines that did allow for persistent progress, but let's not make this another 20-minute conversation about Gauntlet Legends. That's neat too, because then you have a reason to go back and play it, because you're like, oh, I need to save up the upgrade currency so that I can, you know, so that I have more oxygen when I'm playing this Mr. Driller knockoff, which is called, I believe it's called Strike Gold. Their fake games are really good. The last time we talked about Arcade Paradise, I mentioned the, I believe it's called Racer Chaser, which is Pac-Man, but zoomed in close with a mini map in the corner, and then it uses the Grand Theft Auto font for your score, and you are like a Lamborghini running away from cop cars. And it's got this music that plays while you were doing it that has some pretty good gunshots as percussion tracks in it. And yeah, it's just, it's a great silly game, and it's one of the coolest things I think I have played all year. Like that and Tunic are up there for me in terms of like, what are some of the best games that came out this year? Arcade Paradise is really rising up that list super fucking fast every time I play it. Like I'm having such a good time with it. So give that a look. I know we talked about it before, but just wanted to say that game is still cool as hell. All right, why don't we take one more ad break here, and then we'll come back and we'll get into the news. Obviously, you know, Sony raised the price of the PlayStation 5 in some territories, and that's effing crazy. So let's get into this ad, and we'll come back and we'll talk about how insane that is. Huh? How about that? Do you believe in miracles? I believe in miracles, and I believe in Miracle Brand Sheets. Warm weather. It is here. Will it ever go away? I don't know anymore. I think it might be here to stay. But, you know, these nights, not as hot, not as sleepless, due in part to Miracle Brand's self-cooling bed sheets, helping me stay comfortable all night long. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, check out Miracle Brand's self-cooling bed sheets, inspired by silver-infused fabrics made by NASA. Yeah, that NASA. Not the NASA up the street telling you that they'll make bootleg smog certificates for your Camry. This is the real deal. This is real NASA, the space people. Space NASA. Let's talk about these self-cooling properties. Using silver-infused fabrics originally developed by NASA, we've talked about this, Miracle Brand sheets are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long, so you get better sleep every night. And hey, that natural silver that these sheets are infused with, they also prevent 99.9% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than other sheets. That's right. Gross odors that come with other sheets? Hit the bricks. No more. Gone. Out of here. Miracle sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands. The sheets use a premium 500 thread count sateen weave, and it's made from one of the highest quality cottons in the world. Stop sleeping on bacteria. These sheets stay cleaner longer, and clean sheets means less bacteria to clog your pores, so fewer breakouts and other skin problems. That's nice. That's nice. These are all nice things. Cool sheets that stay cleaner longer, clean on your face. Oh. Sign me up. Go to trymiracle.com/Jeff to try it today. And there's a special deal right now for you. Be sure to use our promo code Jeff at checkout to save 40% off. And you know, and you'll get 3 free towels. Yes. Not only will you get an extreme discount of 40%, you will also get 3 free towels. And Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your Sleep with Miracle brand. Go to trymiracle.com/Jeff and use the code Jeff to claim your free three-piece towel set. And you'll save 40% off. What? Again, that's trymiracle.com/Jeff. And thank you, Miracle Brand, for sponsoring this episode. Okay, we're back. And now how about we get into the news? Hey, the PlayStation 5. You've heard of it. You've maybe purchased one. Maybe you're still looking. Maybe you're still hunting. Depending on where you are in the world, the prices went up. Sony announced this on the PlayStation blog back on the 25th, so that is last Thursday. And the headline is, PS5 price to increase in select markets due to global economic environment, including high inflation rates. And so they have raised the price of the PlayStation 5 hardware in a lot of territories except for the United States. And I'll just read this bit from, this is from Jim Ryan, who again is the president and CEO of Sony Interactive Entertainment. The global economic environment is a challenge that many of you around the world are no doubt experiencing. We're seeing high global inflation rates as well as adverse currency trends impacting consumers and creating pressure on many industries. Based on these challenging economic conditions, SIE has made the difficult decision to increase the recommended retail price of PlayStation 5 in select markets across Europe, Middle East, and Africa, Asia Pacific, Latin America, and Canada. There will be no price increase in the United States. New prices are effective immediately, unless otherwise noted. So, in this case, the Japanese price is not going up until September 15th, but the rest of these have already taken place. And so, basically, it seems like currency-wise, you know, it's like a 12% increase in some territories. It's kind of different. So, like, the price in Europe for the full-on with disk drive PS5 is now 550 euros. I meant to, and this is dumb of me to not have this in front of me, but I meant to have the old prices in front of me, but I don't. But yeah, I think generally speaking that's kind of been the increase here. In the UK, it'll go up to £480, which I forget until I see it here in front of me that the UK is back to using pounds and not euros. Like, oh, right. Yeah, I guess they did that dumb thing. In Japan, the price will be moving up to 60,478 yen. Price increases in China, Australia, Mexico, and Canada. In Canada, the new price will be 650 Canadian dollars. That's loonies to you and me, Russ. And the digital edition will be $519.99 Canadian dollars. This just, you know, and so of course this has led to a bunch of people contacting, you know, and there were already some of this work had been done recently, with regard to asking Microsoft and Nintendo, hey, what are we, what's up with your prices? Are you going to raise prices? Because this had kind of been tipped, like this had been Nintendo, I think, issued something saying like, we're not raising our prices. We have no plans to raise our price at this time. And, you know, Microsoft, there's a quote out there that's been going around for a bit here, but Jordan Midler over at Video Games Chronicles has a story here, and the quote from Microsoft reps is, we are constantly evaluating our business to offer our fans great gaming options. Our Xbox Series S suggested retail price remains from £249, yes, and the Xbox Series X is from £449. And so, yeah, I guess that was the thing. Okay, that's the story here, is that they declined to comment earlier in the year when some of this when some of the inflation talk started up, there was a lot of like, oh, is anyone going to raise their prices? Is this going to happen? And Microsoft was a little like no comment about it. And this is, you know, the most they've said. And, you know, Nintendo has also basically said they have no plans to raise the price. I think that this is bad. I don't know. Like, what, you know, what do you want to say? Like, hey, there, you know, this is not how it used to go. And so you've had a lot of, you know, there's been analysts saying this seems like a bad idea. There's been other analysts saying like this is not going to have an impact on sales, or it will have a minimal impact on sales. Again, is Video Games Chronicle has a story citing an analytics firm called Ampere Analysis, which I've never heard of, but there you go. If you think about it, the PlayStation 5 is still largely supply constrained. It is still very hard to find in stores. And so you have to imagine that in the back of their heads, it's not like a driving factor, but they are probably looking at it and going like, well, shit, man, people were willing to pay stock X an additional 150 or more, you know, at various parts of the PlayStation 5's life cycle. The scalper rates went fucking crazy. They are much more in line now because the PlayStation 5 is a little bit easier to find. It's still not widely available. And so I'm sure in the back of their mind, they're like, hey, you know, this isn't going to affect us because people have proven that they're willing to pay even more than we want to charge for one. And there are still people out there like that. They have not sold enough of them yet to where they've hit the people that are very price sensitive. And if we go into full on recession mode and things start to get bad on that front, then you will probably see a case where people are like, oh, I'm cutting back on my spending and now I'm not going to buy a PlayStation 5 at any fucking price. And I think all those factors add up to it. At least I think that's probably why Sony feels like they can get away with this. And I think it's a terrible idea on their part, because I think that there's still, especially if we're going to be in this situation where, you know, if this recession thing does materialize in a full on way, and I know there's some people saying we're already in it and all this sort of stuff, but like there are other signals and factors that just haven't caught up with that. And we'll see if they do. You know, it's just, yeah, the short version is, call me Avis in the chat says, seems unlikely that the economy is getting to get better anytime in the near future. So yes, even if it doesn't get as bad as it could, I think people are getting a little spooked out there. And, you know, I think that's going to impact consumer confidence, not to just like fucking, you know, what the fuck do I know? But I think that's going to have an impact on people's willingness to spend this kind of money on a console, period. And so you end up in a scenario where suddenly the existing Switch, the Switch Lite, some of the prices on that stuff, which again, even those units are not that hard to find, and the Xbox Series S, which is available at a highly competitive price point, are going to look better all the time, especially to those price conscious consumers that want to upgrade, but maybe can't afford a Series X, maybe can't afford a PlayStation 5, especially on the heels of this sort of move. But I think the larger thing is this just looks bad. Imagine you're a developer making games for PlayStation 5, or even imagine you're a developer making games for PlayStation VR 2. And now you're like, okay, like the console's already pretty difficult to find. And I'm a little suspicious about Sony's ability to put enough PlayStation VR headsets out when they do put them out next year. And on top of that, they've raised the price of the PlayStation 5. And you're out there making a VR-only game. So now people will have to buy a PlayStation 5 that they may have to spend even more money on, depending on where they live, and however much the PSVR 2 ends up costing. It doesn't add up to a huge install base for products for that platform, for PSVR 2 specifically. you know, in some cases, it feels like the number of PlayStation 5s out there in the marketplace doesn't always feel like that there are enough of them to... Like, this generation feels like it hasn't even fucking started. Honestly, like, if we really want to break it down, and this is, I think, some of this ties into what I was talking about with, like, it doesn't feel like there are a lot of, like, big budget games. I don't mean big games, because, you know, like, I have games this year. Again, we just talked about Arcade Paradise. Like, there are a ton of games out this year that I fucking enjoy, or that I love. But it doesn't feel like things are up and rolling at the pace that they should be. And maybe this is just the way things are now, but also this seems like it is impacted by the kind of ongoing impact of the pandemic on game development. I'm sure Saints Row suffered from that to a certain degree, right? Where, like, in a world where that didn't happen, would that game be more fully featured? Would it be less broken? Like, there's probably some knock-on effect on some of that stuff. And so when we're in this position where it just feels like that the PlayStation 5 isn't out yet, and I've had one sitting here since before it launched in the US, and I still am like, oh, right, yeah. Because I just play a lot of stuff on PC, and that's just me. You know, there are some people that are just going to be much more, you know, they're going to be console players, and they're going to be much more focused on that. But, like, it feels like the release of games that you go like, oh, this is why I bought a new console. Look at this big, huge, amazing, beautiful video game that can't be done anywhere else. Like, the reasons why people gravitate towards consoles in some cases, you know, it's like, oh, the new console was out and it looks better. And then now it does this and now it does this. Like, you have some of those games, like, obviously Ratchet and Clank came out, Demon's Souls came out. Like, there have been games that you can point to and say, look at that. You couldn't do that before. But it just doesn't feel like there are enough of them. And it doesn't feel like that there's a consistent cadence of those games coming out to justify these purchases. And so it just, yeah, that stuff just feels bad. And I think it, you know, on the Xbox, it ends up being a weirder scenario, right? Where you're like, okay, what is Microsoft doing? Because, you know, when we talk about, you know, what are the big games that push a console? What are the big games that make you want to buy a new console? By and large, there's going to be games made by the hardware manufacturer themselves, because it's in their own best interest to go out there and drum up great reasons for you to buy their machine. And it just doesn't feel like there are enough of those. Sony has put out a fair number of games, whether it's Returnal, and they've got that Last of Us remake coming, which looks, I mean, it's beautiful. Like, it looks great. I have zero interest in it from a video game perspective. Like, I don't care about The Last of Us. I never did, never will at this point. Unless The Last of Us 3 is an auto service. If The Last of Us 3 is a clone of Vampire Survivors, maybe they'll be onto something. But in its current form, I don't care about The Last of Us. They've got God of War coming out. So, like, they've done okay at getting their first party games out there, but it doesn't feel like they've been supported by third parties as quickly or as frequently as you would expect. And so it just doesn't feel like this generation is even rolling. And then you look at the Microsoft side of things, where they, you know, like, what are they shipping this year? There's the Obsidian game, Pentiment. Is that I always forget the actual name of it. I don't think I'm staring at it directly. You know, Forza came out, Forza Horizon came out. But, like, Microsoft is not shipping a ton of games this year that it made itself. We'll probably hear about Deathloop at some point, right? And so they've been focused much more on Game Pass, and they've been focused much more on spending money to get day one exclusives for Game Pass and all that sort of stuff, which has made Game Pass a very interesting service, a very different kind of service than the initial pitch. Because the initial pitch, you were like, okay, great, I'm going to be able to get my hands on all of these first party Microsoft games on day one with my subscription. And that was, like, the main draw. And now, like, that doesn't exist in the same way it used to. Obviously, the older games are still there and all that sort of stuff, but, like, Game Pass has become much more of a, oh, look at these other kind of smaller games that, you know, like getting access to a Midnight Fight Express is a great example of an awesome, awesome game. And having that debut on Game Pass like helps justify why Game Pass is great. And I think Game Pass is great, even without Microsoft having enough games of their own as a primary driver for it. I still think that service works. But it does lend to this kind of ongoing feeling of like, what are these consoles for? What are we doing? How many games do you look at on these platforms and go, wow, this is really taking advantage of the hardware in a huge way? And it just doesn't feel like there's enough. And it doesn't feel like there's enough specifically, I think, from third parties. I think Sony is putting out about as many games as maybe you could expect out of them or since the release of the console. I don't think they're all great games, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. It just feels bad. I don't know. The generation feels bad. And so having Sony come out there now and saying, hey, we're going to raise the price of the PlayStation 5. You're like, okay, well, it already sucked when you changed the game pricing from $60 to $70. And now you're going to come out and say, hey, in this handful of territories, we're going to raise the price of the platform itself. This would normally be the point in the cycle where, yeah, you would start thinking about the first price cut. You'd be like, oh, holidays are coming. Are we going to see like a Black Friday price drop on the PS5? What's going to happen there? Like, you would start thinking about those sorts of things. You might even start thinking about like, oh, is there going to be like a meaningful redesign of the console? Or is there going to, you know, when are they going to do a slim version? What are they going to do? I saw a report saying that there's a new PS5 out in Australia. It doesn't look different, but it's lighter. And so they are making internal changes that probably make them cheaper for them to make and easier for them to make in some cases. So if they're going to start meeting the supply a little bit better over time, then maybe they'll get there. But like, yeah, it feels very backwards. It does not bode well for where we're at, when at the time when we should kind of be thinking about the first price cut or something like that, that Sony's out there being like, hey, stuff's bad, so we are we're gonna raise prices. Like, what, you're gonna raise prices? Like, they make 30% on software sales, you're gonna raise prices? Don't you want, like, they, you used to lose money on every console you sold back in the day. And so they used to make it up on the back end and all those software sales. And so the idea that they're doing this feels bad. And also I look at it as they're doing it because they know they can get away with it. They're doing it because they know the supply situation is what it is right now, and that people are out there paying more from scalpers, and they're not doing it in the US because that is a competitive market with Xbox for them. And so they can't afford to do it here, because if they raise the price of the PlayStation 5 in the States, Microsoft would jump all over it. They're already able to jump all over it because they already have the Series S out there and all that sort of stuff. And so it just strikes me as like they're doing it because they know they can. They feel they have to. And, you know, like the money situation, when we talk about all the acquisitions and all the other stuff that like who's buying what and, you know, all the money that's getting thrown around in the business these days. People like to talk about Sony buying Square, people like to talk about Sony out there, you know, in the same fights for buying publishers as Microsoft, as Amazon, as all this other stuff. But like the truth of it seems to be that Sony, the PlayStation division, just doesn't have the cash flow, just doesn't have the money to spend in that same way. It's easy to forget that Microsoft is a massive fucking company beyond the Xbox stuff, and that they're in a mode where they feel like they can spend to grow their business long term. You know, because Sony kicked their fucking ass last time around, because the Xbox One was a disaster. And so it makes sense for them to be out there trying to continue to grow their business in whatever way they can, because they're like, man, remember when the Xbox 360 was out and times were good? Ugh. Boy. Things were pretty awesome then. Anyway, we really did piss away all that goodwill. And so they've been on this long-term project now for years of rebuilding that trust with the audience and all that other stuff. And so a move like this from Sony, especially in the States, if they were to do it in the States, just opens the door for Microsoft even wider. And Sony does not want to do that. And so that's ultimately why I think you don't see that same price change happening here. And then it's only in some of these other territories, which is fucked up in a variety of ways. But, you know, yeah, anyway, it just feels like they're doing it because they know they can get away with it. And they will. And as soon as things get competitive, if they get a sense that they're like, oh, we can't get away with this anymore, they'll cut it back down. You know, and this will lead to their first price cut, right? Is they'll cut back down to what the original launch price was. You know, maybe they'll do that alongside a new SKU or alongside like, oh, we've redesigned the internals, or, you know, we're going to pack a game in. You know, presumably they'll do a PlayStation VR pack, right? Packing all that stuff together. Maybe we see something around that. I don't know. It seems temporary. And again, if you look at the economic factors that they're referring to, it's not like that shit's not happening. Like, that shit is very much happening. But I think it's smart of Microsoft to say no. It's smart of Nintendo to say we have no plans to raise prices. And I think it makes, you know, like forget the economic factors and forget if we step away from reality of it and just try to like look at it in terms of just like a messaging and all that sort of stuff, it just makes Sony look very bad. Even if it's not happening in the States, it still makes them look desperate in a way that I don't think they actually are. Maybe things are worse, I don't know, but you know, it doesn't seem like they're in some weird desperate spot where they have to do this. And so it just seems weird. It just seems weird and bad. I wouldn't be surprised to see, and maybe they don't have to. I guess actually they don't have to, but you know, if a company like Microsoft wanted to turn the knife on them in this particular moment, they would go into these exact same territories. They would go out to Europe, UK, Japan, China, Australia, Mexico, and Canada, and just be like, hey, we're dropping the price $20. It's just some nominal, just like not even a huge price cut, right? Just something that they can say, hey, we decided to cut the price a little bit on this thing. And that would probably do quite well for them. That, in terms of goodwill, in terms of just like winning a messaging war, whatever, it would probably go a long way for them. But, you know, I'm sure they, for the same reason Sony is raising their price, it's not like Microsoft is out there desperately looking to cut their price either. So, I don't know. It's a mess. It's a mess all around. It's a mess all around. And Sony, maybe Sony has to make up some money here that they spent on buying Savage Game Studios. That was the other announcement from yesterday. Herman Holst, head of PlayStation Studios, announced on the PlayStation blog that they have entered into a definitive agreement to acquire Savage Game Studios, which they bill here as a hugely talented team of creatives with many years of experience making some of the most popular mobile games enjoyed by players around the world. They were founded a few years ago with the goal of fearlessly exploring bold new ideas. And so they have purchased a mobile game studio. I meant to look and see what the heck did Savage Game Studios actually do. I had not heard of them. I don't necessarily follow that space super closely. According to gamesindustry.biz, it was founded in the summer of 2020 with veterans with prior experience at Rockstar, Wargaming, Rovio, and Next Games. That's out of Brendan Sinclair, who's based in Toronto and is feeling the effects of the PlayStation 5 price increase. Did Savage Game Studios actually ship anything? I guess is my big question. It's actually a little bit hard to search for them these days because now all the stories are just about how they've been acquired. Their website has no listing of any games on it at all. So maybe they came together in 2020 and have not shipped anything, but, you know, still were able to sell to Sony. The intent here is to leverage existing PlayStation properties on mobile. The rest of this bit here says, you know, they kind of give some lip service to what they do on PC with Spider-Man and Uncharted coming to PC. And then Herman Holst says, our mobile gaming efforts will be similarly additive, providing more ways for more people to engage with our content and striving to reach new audiences unfamiliar with PlayStation and our games. Savage Game Studios is joining a newly created PlayStation Studios mobile division, which will operate independently from our console development and focus on innovative on-the-go experiences based on new and existing PlayStation IP. All right, so is that the next, what is that? That's like what the next Little Big Planet is now a mobile game, right? Is that, was that what that means? Is like, what are the Sony brands? What are the Sony game brands that you put on mobile? You make a Crash Bandicoot runner? No, wait, they don't own, that's not them. Right, that's not them. Yeah, Ape Escape gotcha game, sure. There's a ton of you could do a mobile version of Jumping Flash all fucking day long. I feel the same way about this as I did when Nintendo announced their intent to get more into mobile games. It makes a ton of sense in terms of, hey, why don't we do something with this stuff on mobile, and maybe that will attract people to these characters that we can then fold back into, you know, make them PlayStation fans through this side door or something like that. Like, it makes sense on paper. In practice, I think the audiences are so different that I don't think it necessarily leads to people becoming into PlayStation. But if they can establish, you know, if they can establish these mobile franchises as just straight up mobile franchises, then hey, that works too. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I just look at it and go like, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, you probably should have been doing this already. In fact, didn't they? I mean, they have had some things. They did some kind of Uncharted thing for mobile at one point, didn't they? That they eventually shut down? Or am I just thinking of the Vita? No, there was some kind of mobile Uncharted thing. And they've done games, you know, I think there's the temptation to do the whole, like, the Mass Effect thing of, what if we did a mobile game that tied into, what if I could work on my galactic readiness on the go? And so there are certain aspects of some games and some franchises where you could see a case for, like, oh, we've got a side game, a kind of secondary experience over here that you could play on your phone. And it's a fun little thing that you can do that helps your character in this other thing. You know, now that Sony owns Destiny, you know, you could, not only could you do some of the same stuff with the vault management and some of the other stuff that, you know, third-party developers have come up with. Well, I guess actually the Destiny, there's an official Destiny app that lets you do that now, right? Anyway, I have not kept track of that stuff, but I know the vault manager and all that other stuff. You could do, you know, you could make an idle game set in the Destiny universe that mines things, that helps the numbers go up, that helps you, you know, it's like that gets you one piece of gear a week or something like that, and still have a fun little thing. You know, you could do these weird side experiences and tie them into the main games, or you could just do individual, like, standalone products on mobile, and that could work as well. You know, it's not an either or. You could definitely do both, and I think that could still work. It's just not that interesting, you know, and having this studio that really hasn't shipped anything as a group. I mean, obviously there are experienced people here, and it says here that they are already working on a new unannounced AAA mobile live service action game. That's a lot of words strung together right there. New unannounced AAA mobile live service action game. Yeah, I don't know. AAA mobile feels like that's a very cursed phrase. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Someone in chat said Destiny Immortal. Yeah. I mean, Destiny is already kind of free to play. So, you know, you could do something. There was a mobile PSO2 game. It was tied into your character and tied into your login. I never was able to play it, 'cause I don't think it ever came out in English, but, anyway, whatever. There's a wide variety of things you could do if you wanted to have a mobile strategy that was complementary to some of your existing products and some of your existing lineup. But like at the end of the day, you know, you've got developers on the console game trying to hit so many different moving targets to get their games shipped. And now suddenly you're asking them to tie in a mobile game and it ends up being some throwaway experience because no one had time to make it good. But you know, if they're going to do their own separate individual thing, that works too. Sure. You know, people are looking for Sony to go out there and buy, I mean, Square, if we're being honest. You know, they're like, oh yeah, Square's divesting of all the stuff they don't want so that they can sell it to Sony. This is exactly how it's going to go. Who knows? That's certainly a possible angle. Or maybe Tencent buys Square someday. You know, maybe Amazon buys Square. We had that roller coaster last week of some shady reporting that you wonder, like, hey, did someone make a bunch of money on stock in this process? Because I woke up at 4 in the morning. I wake up around 4:20, 4:30 a.m. Because that's when our baby boy, he is about to turn a year old, which is insane. And I woke up just in time to read this USA Today article that was going around about the, oh, hey, Amazon's going to buy Electronic Arts today. And that seemed insane. And then as I'm reading the story, it was like on some separate sports/esports section of USA Today, which is already like, okay, I didn't even know that this existed. That's strange. Anyway, and then in the article itself, it was like sources from this weird content mill in Sweden that we have contracted to write esports stories for us indicate that Amazon's going to buy EA. So like the sourcing on it seemed like absolute garbage. And so I'm awake from, it's usually about, let's call it 4:15, or actually literally at 4:20 until about 4:45 or 5 a.m., depending on how long things take. And it takes me a little while to fall asleep, blah, blah, blah. So like in that time, I read it and I read it again. And I was like, something about this feels incredibly off to me. Something about this seems like absolute bullshit. But who knows? Like it seems all, but also this seems incredibly believable that Amazon might buy EA. So whatever. So I went back to sleep. I tweeted something about it, being like, yeah, whatever. We'll see. And then by the time I woke up for real, a few hours later, CNBC had come out and been like, that ain't fucking happening. And so it has not happened since. It doesn't mean it won't happen eventually. Maybe they're still in talks, right? Who knows? But EA has been in talks with a lot of people. The CNBC thing ended up kind of confirming some of the talk about NBC Universal being interested in buying EA. And then this also set off a lot of people saying, hey, Apple was also interested in buying EA, which of the companies that we have listed so far that might buy EA, Apple seems like the absolute worst. I mean, I do not love Amazon, but I don't love Amazon as a, I don't think Amazon would be a good steward of the Electronic Arts brands and IP and history and all of that sort of stuff. I just do not think Amazon is built for this in that way. I think Amazon is built for New World and a handful of other games like that. And they will eventually buy something, and maybe it'll be EA, maybe it'll be Square. They'll eventually buy something big and it will be a bummer. Eventually. It might not be a bummer right away, but I do not believe Amazon has what it takes to truly be in the game space at this scale, at this size, all that sort of stuff. If you told me Amazon was starting a really big mobile division, and they were focusing on, you know, some of the live service stuff they're doing now, New World, or, you know, like some of the other stuff that they're doing now. I look at it and go like, eh, I could see it. Apple doesn't have interest in producing video games for PCs and consoles. Apple has interest in bringing content to Apple platforms. So if you think about what would Apple do if they bought EA, it's all of the stuff that you think about EA doing goes away. Right? I mean, Apple's not going to go like, oh yeah, I guess we still care about shipping games on PlayStation. Maybe they do if they're like, well, this business, that's how this EA business works, is that ships games on PCs and consoles and blah, blah, blah. But I just don't think that they give a shit about that. And so if they were to buy a game studio, which I don't think makes sense anyway, right? I mean, I just don't think Apple, like, I don't think Apple has any real interest in video games. You know, they have interest in Apple Arcade, and sometimes it doesn't even seem like they have a real interest in that either anymore. So, what the fuck would Apple do with it? Other than Apple having interest in the NFL and wanting to broadcast NFL games on Apple TV and wanting to be in that kind of live streaming service. And then you go like, well, if they also controlled the video game rights to football and all that other stuff, maybe there's something there. They could do this and that. But, like, you wouldn't take the whole of EA and be like, all right, now you make games exclusively for Apple platforms. Like, that wouldn't fucking work at any scale. You know, what are you going to take? You're like, oh, yeah, well, originally we were going to do, you know, be like a Gizmondo situation where they're like, we bought the rights to Sticky Balls and now it's only coming out on Gizmondo. And you're like, no, I want Sticky Balls everywhere. Except you would be saying, no, Dragon Age is never going to happen anywhere else. So yeah, I mean, it's easy to look at EA and go, oh, well, fucking EA sucks anyway. But, like, I don't think you want EA to just, like, ghost on console and PC development. And I don't think anyone buying EA would get the value out of EA unless they kept doing that, PC and console development. And I just don't think Apple wants to, I don't think Apple cares enough about to be in that space. So I'm sure they talked because everyone talks, right? But at some point, Apple probably has to look at it and go like, how does this actually fit into what we do as a company? And how does this even make sense? And it just doesn't. So I think Apple is the worst fit of the companies mentioned. But also, I think Amazon, I can't quite explain. I think it's, you know, maybe their track record in the space has been very dicey. When you look at the games that they have, like, dumped a ton of money into and tried to ship. And then, like, remember Crucible? When they shipped Crucible and then unshipped Crucible. Amazon just doesn't seem like they... And also, Amazon doesn't seem like they're in it for the long haul. And maybe that's selfish of me as a fan of video games. But generally speaking, I want these companies to end up in a position where they can keep making video games. And again, I just don't see Amazon as being, like, a successful steward of those brands and those IPs and all that sort of stuff. If anything, I feel like they would be, they will fuck it up even worse. They will stay in. They will continue to try. They will continue to poke at video games. It is something that they are definitely interested in at a corporate level. And, you know, they shipped, you know, the couple of games that they have put out, the couple of MMOs that they have out there right now, seemed like they did achieve a level of popularity, even if New World, the story quickly became about how empty some of those games ended, some of that game ended up being, and all that sort of stuff. But I, when it comes to purchasing existing companies, existing IP, existing stuff like that, it's hard for me to see a path where Amazon cares about that stuff long term and actually sticks it out. You know, the same way, you know, Google still technically runs Stadia. But also dumped all their internal game development. Like, okay. Well, I feel like Amazon would end up in a similar situation where they might just go like, oh, well, we've decided that we just want to license other people's games and not make them ourselves. So we've sold the NFL. We've sold John Madden's likeness to Tencent. We've sold this to that. We've sold, you know, and they end up just taking the five IPs that still matter and distributing them for however much money they can get and then getting out of that business. It's just, yeah, I don't know. Anyway. Seems bad. Maybe this is also informed by, I saw some footage of, some recent footage of Skate 4, of the new Skate, the upcoming Skate. They've been continuing to run betas of that and all that sort of stuff. And I think it looks really good. And it's still a weird, you know, like it still looks like weird pre-release, kind of pre-alpha, like all the same stuff that they've had in that trailer. Like you still see some of that in the product in its current state. But when it comes to looking at it and looking at its bones, it's got good bones looking at that thing. You go like, all right, this looks like you are finding a great way to make a skate game that is something you can continually add on new things and, you know, make that a service, make that an online game that you are expanding on and adding things to over time and having more players in the world at the same time and letting them build with each other and all of that sort of stuff. I think it looks incredibly promising, and it looks like something that they are really striving to get right. And Skate is the perfect type of game to be a service kind of game, because you don't need Skate 4. You don't need, after that, Skate 5, Skate 6, Skate 7. I just want really good gameplay. I want a skate that, like, okay, here we go. This thing plays super well. We have done all the work here on the physics. We have done all this shit. And now we are going to add onto it to make this world bigger and better over time. That is the one of the perfect examples for why you would make a game a live service game instead of, like, shipping another version of it 2 years down the line. You know, I don't want to go have to spend $60, $70 on Skate 5. Let me get this. I will happily spend $60 to $70 a year on Skate if you are putting out additional content. You're like, oh, we've got, here's an add-on for a new area. Here's a season pass. Here's a battle pass to unlock new parts for the part creator or new clothes or something like that. You know, and we've made this very expressive engine for skateboarding that you can then go and have your video editing tools to make your clips and share your clips and, like, making that game, which very much seems like the game they're making from looking at some of the stuff that they are testing out there right now. That's exactly how I want it. I want Skate to be a thing I can return to. It's not a game I'm going to play every day, right? But it's a game I'm going to play a lot of and probably exhaust the launch content. And then from there, I will be happy to come back to Skate every 6 months. They're like, oh, right, Skate. They added some new stuff in Skate. Let's go check out the new shit in Skate. I would love for them to hit that cadence of just like, hey, we've added a new area of town that you can skate around in. We've added a new set of quests. We've added a new area over here, and we've put these three pro skaters are there to talk to you while you do it. You know, like I would be happy to return to that game, enjoy it, and potentially even spend a little bit of money along the way when I come back to it. Like, that's one of those perfect case examples for why a game would make sense to be something more than just a static world with one piece of DLC, two pieces of DLC, and then they move on forever and never touch it again, like Skate 3. Skate 3 had a story mode I finished in like a day or two, you know? And then played quite a bit more of it, but at the end of the day, used up all of that content, and they stopped making that content because they didn't have a good system in place to support ongoing content updates for that game. And that is what live service games can do for you. And I think that is, again, a perfect example of why you would use that sort of thing and do that sort of stuff and just keep on adding new areas, keep on adding, you know, new stuff, and hopefully adding fun new story stuff and little bits and pieces along the way. I think that's great. Denuvo. everyone's favorite digital rights management software is coming to the Nintendo Switch. This is a weird, people fucking hate Denuvo. It is DRM that largely exists on PC games, and in some cases, that DRM has had a performance impact on the games in question, where it runs slightly worse because whatever checks they're doing to make sure that it's a real, proper version of the game ends up having some kind of shitty performance impact. They are now offering a product. This is something Gamescom happened last week, by the way. This is something they announced at Gamescom, and they are selling a product to developers that is called Nintendo Switch Emulator Protection. And this is something that third parties, this is not something Nintendo is involved with. This is something that, according to this Kotaku story, that they got some updates, some updated quotes from Denuvo on this. And Denuvo said, yes, Nintendo is not involved, but the quote is, because of NDAs, we are not allowed to disclose company names, but we can say this solution comes from strong demand from publishing partners. And they also claim it will not hurt in-game performance, but they have said that about their PC stuff before as well. So, I don't know. The protection is designed not to affect the gamer's experience, and it does not have any in-game performance impact. It is the same for this new solution when protection is only active in non-performance critical code parts. And they have also said that it will not rely on online checks. They are aware that the Switch is a mobile console and won't, you know, so their solution will work fully offline. It does not require any kind of online checks, according to Denuvo. This is what you get when, everyone out there runs news stories that are basically like, look at how good Metroid looks at 4K. This is what happens, right? And this is what happens, honestly, when Nintendo ships a first-generation device that is completely compromised at a hardware level. When Nintendo, they shipped a leaky product that you can, get a fucking paperclip and hack a Switch and then do whatever you want with it at that point. And so people have then used that to dump cartridges, and then those cartridge dumps can be run on a PC and blah, 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 and then runs on Steam Deck and all this other stuff. And so by virtue of them, it's not quite PSP levels of easy. It's definitely not Dreamcast levels of easy, but Nintendo made a leaky device. This is Nintendo's fault at the end of the day, or I guess it, technically Nvidia's fault for the way they, the way that the Tegra stuff was implemented or whatever. They came together to result in a device that is very easy to hack and very easy to set up to run pirated games on. However, this product doesn't seem like it is aimed at people that are pirating games on the Switch itself. This stuff seems like it is way more focused on stopping people from running dumps of Switch games on an emulator. Because it is, again, the product is literally called Nintendo Switch Emulator Protection. And so this is something, Denuvo games get cracked. There are some games that sometimes take 3 months for them to crack the Denuvo off of it. But who knows if this is even going to be necessary here. I'm going to say I do think that piracy and the emulation situation probably is impacting sales in a situation where third-party Switch games often don't sell well to begin with. I'm sure I could see hand-wringing third parties being like, we've got to put a stop to this, and blaming the lack of sales partially on specifically the emulation stuff from people who don't even own a Switch. But this, that all feels very paper thin. That just gets into the whole thing of like, are those people going to turn into legit consumers if you block this very easy way, or are they just not going to play it at all, or are they going to find another way? And this used to be, I mean, it's console games. There have been console games with copy protection on them for a very long time. It's not every game. It has not been every game, but there have been plenty of situations where you had PlayStation 1 games with like libcrypt protection on them in ways that would make it more difficult for you to just burn a copy of the game and play it on a modded PlayStation. There are plenty of cases where console games had to be cracked, like cartridge games, like 16-bit, like SNES games and stuff, would have cracks. People have issued cracks for PlayStation 3 games in some cases because of like, oh, well, you know, the activation works differently than the typical PS3 game, and so we had to do this and do that. You know, and so you end up in a situation where like this stuff has existed in different forms for decades and decades. And every step of the way, there has always been a piracy group ready to crack that shit. And we're at a point now where SNES emulation and things of that nature, that stuff has gotten close enough to the real thing that even games that have those protection routines in them are fooled into just running as normal. And you don't have to crack them anymore because the emulators are good enough to just run them. And it just works as the dumps are cleaner, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's a variety of things kind of working in concert to make it so that you don't need to have cracked versions of those games anymore, because they're not out there looking for a fucking super wild card. They're not out there trying to figure out like, hey, is this game being run off a floppy disk? Is this game loaded into memory on some kind of weird copier? Like, that was the stuff they were trying to stop in the SNES days. But now we don't need that. The dumps are cleaner. The dumps are clean. They have no intros on them, as it were. That's why they're named that, because cracking groups used to throw their fucking intros on the front of their console dumps, which is fun if you like crack throws and dumb shit, but like at some point you're like, no, I want the real thing. I don't want it all fucked up, and you cut a thing out and all this other stuff. So this makes you wonder, how long will it take, and will this become some weird cat and mouse game? But like, you know, there are plenty of Switch games that don't run well on emulators because the emulation is not done yet. They have not implemented the full breadth of the Switch technology, and so you have games that come out that just don't run. And sometimes they fix them, and sometimes they're like, oh, we'll get around to that someday, but it's a hard problem to fix, so whatever. And so this just adds de novo to that list of like, hey, yeah, we have not properly emulated this part of the Switch yet to look exactly like a real Switch. But now de novo is painting a fucking gigantic fucking target on themselves and on this stuff. And they have given these emulator authors an additional reason to introduce even more accuracy to their emulators to get around that protection without having to crack it off in the first place. So how this will start is you will have cracking groups that go out of their way to crack the de novo off of the games. And I can't speak to how hard or how easy that'll be. I don't fucking know. But you will have a situation where you're like, oh, okay, well, this is a cracked version of this game because it's got de novo. We had to crack it. And now it runs on an emulator because we cracked it. But the emulator authors will also suddenly be incentivized to go like, oh, this is an interesting new problem to tackle. Let's see if we can do this, and set out to improve the accuracy of their emulators more and more and more to make sure that they are emulating every last bit of the Switch accurately, so that that protection code just looks at it and goes like, yep, that's a real Switch, all right. All they're really ever trying to do with this stuff, and I think it's why you see games that get de novo removed from them eventually. But the thing they're trying to put a stop to when they go and implement something like de novo, or you know, when they implement any kind of copy protection on a game, is because they're trying to protect the launch window of that game. What they want to happen is they want to get however many days they can get, 90 days. If they can get through the first 3 months of a game's release with a game uncracked, then the people who want to play that game will just buy that game. But if on day one, if you can go like, oh yeah, you could buy that game, or you could click this button right here and play. Like, there was that Spider-Man remaster that came out on PC, like, people were waiting for some cracked version. Like people were going crazy, going like, I can't wait for that to come out so I can download it. Like, I don't see a lot of like PC piracy chatter anymore, but for whatever reason, the Spider-Man thing rose to a level of discussion that I ended up seeing quite a lot of people talking about it, and seeing numbers of like, oh, there's like 250,000 people orienting this game right now or whatever. And so those numbers are fucking significant, right? I mean, if you are a game maker and you look at that and try to, and in your head, if you try to do the thing, which is kind of a fallacy of like, oh man, if 250,000 more people bought our game, that would be a massive change. Of course, the reality is never quite as cut and dry as that. You have some people who would never pay full price for the game anyway. And, you know, I don't know. PC piracy seems like a fucking waste of time to me. Maybe that's just, you know, I'm an adult now. But so many games go on sale so frequently now. And Steam is so convenient. I mean, that's the thing, you know, for all the people that go like, oh, Epic Game Store, gross. Like, all those people are saying, no, I want to buy my games legally on Steam, because if Epic Game Store is a hassle, then I'm sure downloading and pirating games and, you know, cracking them and doing all that stuff and whatever you need to do to get that stuff to work is probably even more of a hassle, right? It's just a weird, I don't know, it's a weird turn of events. But the Nuvo on Switch seems like a ridiculous thing, but if they end up protecting a game for the first 3 months, whatever it is, then hey, then maybe that ends up helping those developers in some specific way. I don't know. I have a hard time believing that it will make a meaningful difference. And some people in the chat, so since I talked about the hassle of pirating games and stuff like that, and saying like, oh, there, a lot of people in chat right now are saying like, actually the piracy stuff is not a hassle at all. You know, it's also not a hassle installing and buying games from the Epic Game Store. And yet people complain non-fucking stop about like, oh, I can't believe I have to install this other store. Like, in a world where people can't even be bothered to install the fucking second client that also just installs games and runs them when you push the fucking button. Like, I don't know. Seems like a pretty flimsy argument to me. Anyway, this Denuvo on Switch thing seems like an absolute fucking farce, and I don't think it will actually help. And I will be very interested to see how those emulators progress. Like, in some ways, this almost seems like, oh, this is gonna be a really good way to get those emulators to have more accuracy and you know, get further developed and all of that sort of stuff. This also does, obviously, you know, it's probably worth saying here, emulation is not illegal. Dumping your games and playing them on different hardware, that is not a crime. I don't know if we need to make bumper stickers or something, but dumping your own Switch games and running them on Yuzu or something like that is, you know, it's funky. It's a gray area in some ways in terms of how the DMCA is written and all of their bullshit, but that is not a crime. And Nintendo has fought for years, and you know, I think there are probably still pages on Nintendo.com that say, actually, emulation is illegal, but the emulators are not illegal. They just straight up aren't. And I'm not worried about that aspect of it. But this will prevent people, you know, if developers even use this, right? I mean, Denuvo is claiming that, like, publishers came to them and said, you gotta help us. You gotta make a product that saves us from this piracy problem. And that's why they developed this, you know. But who actually uses it? How many publishers actually take them up on this? And does it make an impact? We'll see. We'll see. It's a fascinating turn of events. Not one I saw coming, for sure. But at the same time, I just look at it and go like, this seems like only good news for people in the emulator scene, because it will it will incentivize, it will further incentivize the developers of those emulators to make them even more accurate, if only to say, yeah, our emulator's accurate enough to fool this Denuvo bullshit into thinking it's a real cart. So fuck them. This is fascinating. What else is going on? 2K and Hangar 13 have confirmed that there's a new Mafia game in development. This was part of an interview that came out alongside the 20th anniversary of the release of the first game. And the quote from Roman Hladek, I'm probably not pronouncing that right, says, "I'm happy to confirm we've started work on an all-new Mafia project. While it's a few years away and we can't share anything more right now, we're really excited to keep working on this beloved franchise and to entertain our players with new stories." That's from Polygon's recap of the 2K post. That's okay. Yeah, they should make another Mafia, I guess. I don't know. I have never had a big connection with the Mafia franchise. I know that they have done some intriguing things with that series over the years, but when those first couple came out, just like it's Mafia 2 specifically, it was just like, this world seems so empty. And Mafia 3 was real awkward, and yeah, it's, I don't know, the Mafia franchise, they made it 20 years and that's awesome, and they should make another one and see how it goes. But yeah, you know, they don't have anything more to say about it other than it's a few years out, so we'll see some more of that over time. As I said, Gamescom happened, and there's not a ton of news out of Gamescom, which is typical Gamescom. I thought that maybe we would have a bigger than normal Gamescom in terms of new announcements and new details on games and all of that sort of stuff. But it was relatively limited, I'll say. And it felt a lot like, Gamescom used to be the kind of mop-up post E3 show where E3 happens and you have all of the massive, massive announcements. And then Gamescom happens and you see, like, here's everything that Focus Home Interactive is working on, for example. And a couple of other announcements that are maybe more focused on the European market. Here's Football Manager. That sort of stuff. In a year when the June kind of the E3 time frame this year felt very underwhelming, I guess I thought that maybe that opened the door for a bigger Gamescom, but it doesn't seem like that happened. Lies of P was shown, and that is the Pinocchio themed Souls like game, which is a fun sentence to say out loud, and that looks cool. What else? New Tales from the Borderlands was confirmed. That had leaked out. Dead Island 2. Obviously, Dead Island 2 was announced 45 years ago, when our boys were overseas getting it done. They announced Dead Island 2 shortly after the conclusion of World War II, and then it fell off the... No, 2014. 2014 is when Dead Island 2 was announced. And then it went through other developers all this other stuff. Anyway, it's back. It's coming early next year, February 3rd. And it's set in LA, which is not an island. But hey, what are you going to do? It looks okay. I don't know. Like, post Saints Row, I think there's a certain aspect of Embracer Group's output that I am even more suspect of at this point. So we'll see what Dead Island 2 ends up being. It's got, whatever. The stuff they showed looked nice. Callisto Protocol was shown again. That game continues to look like a cool Dead Space-ish sort of thing. They had a Gotham Knights trailer, which for a game that's out in October, I would have thought that they would have focused more on gameplay, but there was zero gameplay in that trailer. I know they have put gameplay out before, but that just, it felt awkward to me. They announced a Killer Clowns from Outer Space game, which, hey, why not? They showed some more Sonic Frontiers, and I don't think that that necessarily... I don't think that calmed anyone's nerves. Anyone that was anxious about the quality of Sonic Frontiers, I don't think anything they showed at Gamescom necessarily is going to sway anyone going, oh, I guess I was wrong. It looks great. Like, that game, what they showed in that stuff looks like the stuff I played back in June. You know, they showed Homeworld 3, Dwarf Romantics coming to consoles. They announced a PlayStation 5 high-end controller called the DualSense Edge. And it's... You can replace the sticks, and so it's going to come with high dome, low dome, and normal sticks. You can replace the... It's going to have back triggers. You'll be able to configure the layout of the controller on the controller itself through a new function button. And I want something that lets me swap out the D-pad. Like one of my favorite things about the Xbox Elite controller was the ability to swap out the D-pad between multiple D-pads that felt good for different types of games. And I think that that was one of the coolest things about that controller. The DualSense Edge will also have trigger stops or like adjustable triggers in terms of like, do you want a shorter throw? Do you want less of a dead zone for more precise control? Those are the sorts of things they're billing. They did not have any details on price or availability as of yet. But it doesn't, I don't know. I don't think it looks like it's necessarily doing the things I would want out of a kind of pro controller, specifically the D-pad stuff on the Elite controller seemed like a big deal to me on the Xbox side of things. But actually, I stopped using my Elite controller. I have an Elite Series 2, and it's all fine and good, but I started using the Xbox Series controller for PC games. And I think it's fine. I think the D-pad they came up with on that, I wish it was a little less loud. As someone who sometimes plays games in a room with a sleeping child, the loud, clicky D-pad on the Xbox controller is sort of a bummer. And we'll see. I don't know. It's about time for Sony to do something in the controller space, I guess. But I don't know that what they showed is necessarily a huge... It doesn't immediately look like a huge and clear improvement. It looks like stuff you go like, okay, yeah, that's stuff that some people might want to toggle out. But none of the things they're offering are things that I have a problem with the current PlayStation 5 controller. So I think the analog sticks on that thing are pretty much exactly what I would want. But I wouldn't mind having the ability to swap in a different D-pad. In fact, some of the face buttons, like if we're really thinking about this, I wouldn't mind the ability to make some changes to the face buttons on the PS5 controller. Just in terms of the throw on them feels weird. They're fine. It's fine. This controller is fine. It's a little heavy, if anything else. If I am commenting on the quality of these controllers, I feel like the PlayStation 5 controller is a little bit heavy. But it's a heck of a controller otherwise. You know, just the ability to swap in a different D-pad from time to time might be nice for certain types of games, fighting games, what have you. I wouldn't mind that, but it doesn't seem necessary at the same time. So we'll see. I don't know. Depending on the price, maybe that's still an okay buy. Also, as part of Jeff Keighley's Opening Night Live broadcast, they showed Everywhere, which is the game from, I'm sorry, what is the name of it? Build a Rocket Boy, which is the studio founded by Leslie Benzies, who you may know as The Benz, who you may know as the former producer of Grand Theft Auto and all of that sort of stuff. Everywhere is the kind of big, wide, sweeping thing that they have been off working on for years, I believe, on Amazon's Lumberyard. Well, actually, no, this is... They announced saying that they were going to use Lumberyard, the Amazon engine, but I guess they are no longer using that. The trailer just looks like a big thing. You just go like, oh, look at all this big, this looks like a big weird game. What is this? They didn't necessarily get into too much detail there in terms of what you do, but a lot of different visual styles and things going on, and you're like, okay, well, we'll see what that ends up being. Shortly after the trailer hit and people started digging into it, people noticed that Build a Rocket Boy is hiring for a lot of blockchain-based positions, senior back-end programmer. This is according to Video Games Chronicle. Senior back-end programmer, smart contract developer, and a test engineer. Which has, of course, people thinking, well, this... Even, like, I will say, before this stuff surfaced, looking at the trailer for that with, like, modern context in mind, it's very easy to look at it and go, like, oh, this could be a big fucking NFT nightmare. If they wanted to, because it looks like a metaverse style of thing of like, look at all these different styles and visuals and all this other stuff. Like, it looks like it could be that type of nightmare. There's a really good quote here. So anyway, people found these positions and were like, oh, well, if everywhere is a blockchain game, fuck that game, which I think is a very sane position to take. Absolutely. And there's a quote here. So I'll read the full quote. No, I'm going to read this sentence of the quote first. We are building everywhere on Unreal Engine 5, not the blockchain. As if blockchain was a full-on video game engine that you would compare. Like, it's the dumbest. Like, that's a statement from the studio who ostensibly knows how to make video games on video game engines like Unreal Engine 5 and potentially Amazon Lumberyard. And so, even renderware. Hell, these people have been making games for a long time. Just the actual sentence itself just feels so talking down to, like, just so stupid. How dumb do you think people are that your sentence is, we are building everywhere on Unreal Engine 5, not the blockchain? You must think that, like, people are actual fucking, anyway, the full quote. From a studio representative on Reddit. We're seeing some conversation on NFT/cryptos that are prompted by some of our open positions on our website. These are research positions, as we do not like dismissing new technologies only because others haven't found a solution for them yet. We are building everywhere on Unreal Engine 5, not the blockchain. We are creating a new world for players where we come together to play, watch, create, share, and so much more. We hope this helps clarify some of the speculation around this topic. It super fucking doesn't. It absolutely does not. In fact, this, like, shady seeming answer makes me assume that, like, oh, like, you are absolutely building a bunch of fucking, like, crypto shit into this Unreal Engine 5 game or however you end up monetizing it. Because if it is, it does look like some really large, I mean, it is called Everywhere. It does look like this kind of, you know, there's a variety of looks and a variety of graphical styles shown in some of the footage. It's very easy to look at it in a metaverse type of lens right now and go like, oh, is this something where players, you know, obviously they do say that players are going to be able to create. And so you go like, okay, so is this maybe like, do you end up with a Roblox-esque sort of thing here? Do you end up with, you know, like players creating their own spaces and managing them? Are you making a Second Life-esque sort of thing here? Like, what is the true scope of this project? And it looks very wide and very big. And so it's very easy to look at that and go like, oh, it sure would be a shame, but also I understand how a developer might come to this and say, we've decided that we're going to, you know, oh, you can buy land for your trailer park or whatever you want to build, and the blockchain will say that you own it. And maybe this is just a research thing, and because I'll tell you, more companies than you know of have invested in this type of research. You know, hardware manufacturers, different publishers, and, you know, like some of them are out there on record talking about it. Some of them are not. But a lot of them have at least done the work and spent money, whether it was through acquiring a company or hiring people for these sorts of positions, to do the research. And many of them came away saying, oh, we absolutely don't want anything to do with this, but now we know for sure. Now we know internally, even if they don't, even if they're not going to go address it in stockholder meetings or in a real way, and they're just going to say, like, we have nothing to announce, or hey, we don't, you know, and not go into, well, we bought this company over here and then we looked at it for a long time and decided it was absolute bullshit. And so, you know, again, I think there is, you know, it does make sense to at least do some of the research, but I think increasingly more and more of that research has been done. And the positions that they are hiring for seem awfully specific for, you know, research. So what does this mean for the future of everywhere? I think it has huge question marks around it. I think that this answer feels very hand wavy to me. It feels more like, oh, it's just the, again, we are building everywhere on Unreal Engine 5, not the blockchain. As if a game wouldn't be both. If they were to make a game that integrated the blockchain, as if you could develop a full video game and run it on the blockchain, that's what we need. There's not enough power and you know, not enough CPU cycles being devoted to the blockchain these days. We've decided we're going to start running video games on it now too. Can we do that? Blockchain, is that an engine? Is that an engine yet? Is blockchain asset store? Can I get cool tanks to put in my video game? So yeah, I don't know. This response from them feels very shitty to me, and feels very like, like I said, I read this and go like, oh, you are absolutely planning to integrate the blockchain into this video game because this answer is so fucking weird. And so, like, yeah, it just seems like a bad way to go. Steam Deck. I love it. I love the Steam Deck. I think the Steam Deck is an incredible device. I've been having a ton of fun with it. I've been playing quite a bit of Arcade Paradise on the Steam Deck. It runs really well there. I was enjoying Rumbleverse on the Steam Deck for a while, but their anti-cheat stuff broke it. And so the Steam Deck is a weird, interesting, fun, tinkery, strange device. In conjunction with the upcoming Tokyo Game Show and kind of the launch of pre-orders in more regions for the Steam Deck, Valve put together a booklet kind of describing what is this, not only what is the Steam Deck, but what is Valve and what is Steam. Because when they get into these regions where Steam is not super well known, like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, like these are the sorts of areas that they're, you know, launching these pre-orders in, they have to go in and say like, hey, we have been in this business for a really long time. We're not just like out here nowhere. Like, so, I mean, the first, you know, some of the first text is Valve began in 1996 as a game developer, which you almost expect the next sentence to be like, yeah, we don't make games anymore. We're Valve. We don't have time to make games. And so it's an interesting pitch, this PDF that they put. So they decided to put this PDF out so anyone could look at it. This is stuff they're going to be handing out, the Japanese version of it at TGS and all of that sort of stuff, right? So it's really focused on those markets, but they did do an English version and they put the PDF on their site just so you could check it out. And it's a fascinating little thing that has some sentences about Valve itself. And some of the things that say how they view the Steam Deck, or at least how they're trying to pitch the Steam Deck. So here's a little, it's a few bits and pieces here. Valve as a company is itself designed and organized based on the same principles of openness and access that define the open PC community. A good idea for a game, a Steam feature, a hardware product can come from anywhere, an employee, a partner, or a member of the community. Steam Deck reflects this core Valve philosophy. Its hardware is meant to be upgraded and modified. And so there's a sentence here that, you know, they say what the Steam Deck is. It's a game console that can also make games. It's hardware that is meant to be hacked. It's an open OS with capabilities that will be expanded by the community. And then this one, when you're done playing games, what will you make with your Steam Deck? Which is an interesting pitch. I think some developers have in the wake of this come out and said, like, yeah, absolutely. I am partially coding a game directly on the Steam Deck and all this sort of stuff and using it in testing and so on and so forth. I think the truly interesting part of this, though, they go through a lot of different, they talk about what the version of Steam that runs on the Steam Deck and how much of the catalog is available. Hey, thousands of games are available, and here's a teardown of the unit, and here's some pictures of prototypes and all of this sort of stuff. But then you get near the bottom here, and it says, the future, : more Steam Decks, more Steam OS. Steam Deck represents the first in a new category of Steam handheld gaming PCs. In the future, Valve will follow up on this product with improvements and iterations to hardware and software, bringing new versions of Steam Deck to market. Like the original and all PCs, these future products will continue to provide access to the same Steam game catalog that gamers already know and love. And then there's some smaller versions, some smaller text around that that talks about Proton, which is the compatibility layer, and how SteamOS will continue to evolve. And also, the work that has gone into Steam Deck's user interface will soon be available through the desktop client as a new version of Big Picture, the version of Steam that's meant to be used with a game controller and on a television screen. That's good. I have never liked Big Picture mode. I always thought that interface looked bad and was a little clunky. I think the Steam Deck interface is way better than what Big Picture mode has been. And so I think that's really cool. They also say, and the compatibility work for Steam Deck will be inherited by other platforms like Chrome OS, which will soon provide support for Steam gaming for all Chromebook users. Anyway, it's like weird to have the word anyway in this booklet. Anyway, this is a multi-generational product line. Valve will support Steam Deck and Steam OS well into the foreseeable future. We will learn from the Steam community about new uses for our hardware that we haven't thought of yet, and we will build new versions to be even more open and capable than the first version of Steam Deck has been. What would you like to see in a future version of Steam Deck? Let us know. And so I think this is stuff that was incredibly obvious, right, when we think about the future of Steam Deck. But I also think that having them come out and say it this definitively, that yes, we will continue to make more Steam Decks down the line, is big. It's big news. It's also great, again, as a Steam Deck owner, selfishly. I love the idea for the Steam Deck. I love the way it executes on that idea. I think that it is such a fucking cool device. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But the OS improvements that they have issued, even since I got mine a month or two ago now, are significant and meaningful. And so obviously this hardware is going to become obsolete someday, and they will be able to make a more powerful Steam Deck. The first generation of Steam Deck is awesome, but not necessarily a game changer on its own. But with their commitment to a long-term future for the Steam Deck, you start to see more and more scenarios where this becomes a device that more and more people can use, even if they don't have experience on the PC. And you're seeing more and more of this. Like, you know, I found myself reading fucking Reddit. I don't like Reddit. I think it's a fucking bad website. But sometimes it is the fastest way to get certain types of information out of certain communities. And so I read the Steam Deck subreddit. which is terrible because most of it is people talking about how their shipments got stolen or hey, I got my order. You know, like there's not as much actual meat and potatoes about using the Steam Deck. It's mostly just people going like, look at this box. And you're like, cool, great. But you see posts here and there, whether it's there or just like message boards, like you're starting to see more and more people who are just like not familiar with what Steam is and how it works and some of the weird deep rabbit holes you can go into with the Steam, different parts of the Steam community and profiles and all the other stuff you can change on your Steam profile that if you have never used Steam before, except in, on your Steam Deck, might not make a ton of sense. And it's fascinating that we're starting to see a little bit more use out of people who are not using the Steam Deck as like their second PC or their second Steam device. You know what I mean? That people might buy one and go like, oh, okay, I don't play games. I normally play games on consoles, but I wanted to get a Steam Deck, which I think is a really smart move in some ways because the Steam Deck is more powerful than a Switch. Runs many of the same games, especially at the indie level, that you would see on a Switch, but oftentimes those games go on sale a little more frequently on Steam. And so obviously it's a greater outlay of money up front, because the Steam Deck is certainly more expensive than a Switch. Well, I guess the cheapest version is not, you know, it's within spitting distance, but you know, you can go up from there. And so I, you know, as I said, when I wrote a review of the Steam Deck, which is up on Patreon, if you want to read it, patreon.com/Jeff Gerstmann, I don't think that the Steam Deck in its current form is the perfect device for new players, for people who have not seen Steam anywhere else and all that sort of stuff. I think it's best suited for people who already play games on a PC and all that sort of stuff, but they will get there. And what does that, you know, I think specifically, what does that mean for Nintendo? What does that mean for the third party support on whatever Nintendo's next device is? You know, already the third party support on Switch is dicey. They get a lot of games, but like, you know, increasingly that hardware is getting old, and increasingly that hardware does not stand up. And so you're starting to look at the Switch and go like, this is a pretty old device. There sure is room for a newer, fresher version of this that runs better. And so on and so forth. But then you've also got the Steam Deck. And obviously Nintendo will always be able to fall back on its first party video games, which are the reason, that's the main reason people buy a Switch, is to play those games. But if you're out there trying to like provide, and the Switch has been great for a lot of those smaller indie games and all that sort of stuff. And that's been the kind of the two concurrent stories of the Switch are, here are Nintendo's big games, and then here's a wide swath of smaller, incredible video games that run perfectly on the Switch. If you have a situation where now you've got a device that can run, you know, Spider-Man Remastered acceptably well, and Cyberpunk, and you know, like these kind of big ticket PC games, Halo Infinite runs acceptably well on that. If you iterate on the Steam Deck and have upgraded hardware that can run games like that even better, and you're putting it up against, you know, like a second gen Switch, eventually, I think Steam Deck becomes a meaningful threat to parts of Nintendo's business. Right now, not the case. Right now, you look at it and go like, it's too big. It's too, you know, like the size of it is, you know, I actually don't think the size of the Steam Deck is a real problem. It's a beefy device, no doubt. But I also find it very manageable. I have sizable hands. That might be part of it. I got big hands. Not the hugest hands. People have bigger hands, for sure. I'm not saying I have the biggest hands in the world. But I think that the Steam Deck fits great. It's an awesome device. It could use an OLED screen. It could use, always could use more power. But I think at the resolutions that, that the screen is, the what like 800p, you know, like was it 1200 by 800, whatever it is. Like when you run a game like Spider-Man at that resolution, it looks fucking great on that screen. And you look at it technically and the things you have to turn off and stuff like that, you're like, well, I guess, you know, technically it is not the best looking version of that game because I could be sitting in front of a 3090, well, I am sitting in front of a 3090 and running that at 1440p and, you know, hell of megahertz. Hell of hertz, hell of frames per second, and all of that sort of stuff. But I think when you think about what you want out of a handheld device, I think the Steam Deck does just about everything I personally would want out of a handheld device. It needs a better battery. It needs a better battery. I think that in its current iteration, a better battery would go a long way, but also future iterations that are more powerful that have, again, an OLED screen would be fucking awesome. HDR. Like if you had an OLED screen and HDR on a fucking Steam Deck, that'd be fucking crazy. Yeah. 120 Hertz. That'd be a good one too. Yep. Absolutely. And so what is a new Switch? What is Nintendo's follow-up to the Switch going to end up being power-wise? Because they're going to want to, you know, and they're going to want to hit that mainstream consumer price point, right? They're going to want to always have a device that is reasonably priced because they want it to be a big mainstream thing. I don't know if Valve will get there or if that's something that they, where they prioritize the pricing. I mean, obviously this is their first iteration and the thing goes up to what's the high end? It's like $600 or something, right? Which is a fucking hell of a lot of money, honestly. But hey, you know, I think the Steam Deck has a ton of potential. It's been a great place to play games. It's been a great place to tinker and fuck around with and all of that stuff. And it being an open device out of the box and it just being like, check out this Linux machine. It's just been cool too, but honestly, just straight up, it runs games well. A lot of them, a lot of games that you wouldn't even think would, like bigger games than you would think would run on a handheld, you know, obviously all the same kind of indie stuff that runs on the Switch really well. You know, most of that stuff's on Steam. Most of it runs really well there too. But, again, you get to these bigger games, these, you know, larger experiences and stuff like that, and you go like, wow, this stuff actually still runs really well here too because of the resolution of the screen and all of that sort of stuff. Like, you know, you have situations where like, yeah, Spider-Man runs really good, God of War runs well, you know, Forza can be a little chunky at times but runs well too. Like it's I say acceptably well because I'm comparing it to it running on a full-on PC because it is the same game running on multiple platforms, you know. And so obviously people are going to have different types of PCs. It may be that the Steam Deck is better at running games than your actual fucking desktop PC is, depending on, you know, when you last upgraded, all of that sort of stuff. I upgraded recently enough that this PC is significantly more powerful than a fucking Steam Deck, but you still get a whole lot of frames out of the version running on Steam Deck. And it's just crazy at times. Like you just, it has that feeling sometimes of like, I can't believe this game on this handheld looks as good as it does and runs as well as it does. And I think that that's pretty awesome. And so them turning this into a full on product line and all that sort of stuff, you have to start to wonder like, when does this just become its own platform? When does this become, obviously they want it to remain open. They want it to remain kind of like, hey, it's a Linux PC. It's this sort of thing. But when do you have more and more developers starting to like, what's the sales number that they have to cross before more and more developers are going to take the Steam Deck version of their game seriously? It was awesome to see, I believe it was Spider-Man had patch notes that specifically referenced the Steam Deck. And I think that's fucking badass. Developers that are out there trying to be early adopters of the Steam Deck and caring about how their game runs there, I think it's really neat. It's something that probably ends up benefiting people on multiple PCs. Like, you know, if they're doing that cleanup work and getting all that stuff going, it probably helps across the board. It's not just a pure Steam Deck improvement in some cases, but I think that's really outstanding. But also at the same time, how many Steam Decks have to be out there in the marketplace? How many Steam Deck specific sales does a developer have to see before they go like, oh, well, we're shipping our game on PC and console and stuff, but we should really think about how it runs on Steam Deck. Like how when does that become part of that process? When does that become a meaningful audience to address directly, as opposed to like, yeah, I don't know, it's this weird Linux device. It's fucking crazy, right? I don't know. I guess it runs our game. We'll do some minor stuff to, you know, have the right settings, or, you know, like we'll do this minor tweak that'll help, but like we're not going to go out of our way to, but like, yeah, when are there enough Steam Decks in the marketplace for that to be a meaningful segment of the audience? And for some developers, that's already, because, you know, you have smaller indie devs and stuff that are going to be more receptive to any pocket of players that they can address. And so there is that kind of, it's a bit of a land rush, a bit of a land grab, where you're like, in the early days of Steam Deck, if you're a developer out there being very attentive to like that community's needs, they're probably going to go, that's really cool that they care about me. I'm going to buy their game. And so there are probably some smaller teams that end up benefiting from that. But then, gosh, are they going to fuck around and make Linux on the desktop matter? Is that how this ends up? That's scary after all these years. But yeah, it's been super fun to watch. It's a really just exciting new segment of like offshoot of the PC market. And it's a fun, weird new thing to tinker with on top of that. And that's fun too. And it's just, yeah, I don't know. It's fucking cool. At the end of the day, the Steam Deck is one of the fucking coolest things happening right now in video games. I get so excited about it. It's just such a neat fucking thing. And to see Valve finally actually do something, you know, after the Steam machines and all of that sort of stuff, like to finally have a situation where they've found a, you know, and it's ironic in a way, because they found a way to make Linux matter by just making Windows games run better on Linux. It's not a situation where they have to go out of the way like, you've got to make a Linux native version of the game. It's like, no, Valve is just like, I guess we have to really invest in this whole Wine and Proton and all these layers and all this other stuff and figure out ways to do most of this work for developers, because they are not going to fucking do it on their own. And the Linux port is always going to be an afterthought, and it's going to run like shit compared to the Windows version, so on and so forth. So anyway, that's neat. Steam Deck. It's fucking cool. Like it's stupid. If you order a Steam Deck now, you'll get one in Q4, which is kind of right around the corner in a grand sense. But they keep saying like, oh, we've improved our shipping times, so you're going to get your Steam Deck faster if you ordered one, and all this sort of stuff. And now there's some disgusting, sick part of me that, because they were so hard to get for so long, and because I spent a long time going like, when am I going to get my fucking Steam Deck? Like, desperate to try one out. Every time I open the Steam client on desktop, the Steam Deck is the number one thing that it shows, because it's like the number one trending, you know, whatever. And every time I see it, I go, ooh, I should buy a Steam Deck. And I'm like, I already have a Steam Deck. And I go, yeah, but I could get another one. Like, that's dumb. That's insane. That's a crazy person would do that. But at the same time, I have a really big Steam library. My wife would benefit from it. I don't know. I'm not going to do that. She wouldn't use it enough. She plays games on her Switch Lite occasionally, and she just wants to play Bayonetta 3 at this point. So, so yeah. Anyway, short version of that story is, I love the Steam Deck. I love what it has the potential to do to the video game business. It's just a weird, it's a weird left field thing that came along, and has the potential to make some weird, meaningful changes to the video game business as it relates to, like, you know, does it impact Nintendo's third-party business someday? Not now, obviously. You know, 5 years down the line or something, is that a meaningful device? I don't know. Yeah, it's just it's a fascinating, unexpected twist that is out there doing big things, and it's exciting. It's just very exciting hardware. It's a cool new thing. Anyway, last little story here. They showed the AEW video game at Gamescom. They showed off gameplay for the first time, or a full match. They had shown some gameplay in the trailer. But they showed off more of the game. They let people touch it. They showed the controls, all of that sort of stuff. It's weird. AEW Fight Forever, all along, they have been trying to position it adjacent to, like, they keep trying to invoke WWF No Mercy, the N64 game that was made by Aki. AEW Fight Forever is being developed by Yuke's, which is the studio that invented the WWF, I guess it was F at that time, the SmackDown games that came out on PlayStation 1, and then Yuke's became the developer of record for the WWE games on those platforms and eventually all platforms for a very, 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 very long time. And Yuke's is... when those first SmackDown games were coming out, it was a breath of fresh air. It was like, here's a fast-moving wrestling game. It feels good compared to all of the sluggish shit that's out there right now. And then eventually just the Yuke's games became bogged down and the same thing year in, year out. And just like, I don't know, it just became very weird and frustrating and boring more than anything else. So at the time they said, like, oh, we went out and found the director of those Aki games at Sin Sophia, whatever they're called now. And that person is involved in the project in some specific way, but Yuke's is still developing the game. And so you have this weird situation where they keep trying to reference, and they did this at Gamescom, where they talked about Virtual Pro Wrestling 2, because they don't like talking about, because Virtual Pro Wrestling 2 was a landmark game and people legitimately love it, but they also don't want to get out there and say, we loved that WWF game and we want to make a game like that, because that's just a weird thing for a competing promotion to be out there saying. And so it's this weird thing where you have Yuke's, the developers that came up with a style of game that I think in some ways, in terms of the marketplace, like, it replaced those N64 games as the N64 was kind of on its way out and all that sort of stuff. Like, that engine was kind of falling away. It wasn't happening as much. You know, eventually the Def Jam games got it in some form and all that sort of stuff. And then Yuke's just became the team that made all of the wrestling games, and they made them totally different. And now you have that team going back and trying to make a game that is vaguely like those N64 games. It's weird. It's just conceptually really fucking strange. But what it does mean is that it's a game with, like, what looks like relatively simple control scheme. And the action looks pretty dynamic. People are all over the place with their takes on how that game looks. I think it looks and moves well. I kind of like the way that game moves. And so I'm potentially interested in it, even as someone who I only have some respect for those Aki games on the N64 and the Def Jam games that came after them. It just felt too sluggish and slow to me at the time when we started, when I became involved with the League of Heels, the rogue PAX wrestling organization that forced a lot of people to learn how to play, or at least attempted to get people to learn how to play some of those Aki N64 games, specifically how to get out of the ring and in the ring, and, you know, throw people out of the ring and how all the controls work. I gained a level of respect for those games at that point. I was like, oh, okay, I see the appeal here. I don't think that it is it just never felt like a good representation of real wrestling to me. You know, it felt like this is all stuff that makes total sense from a video game standpoint, but in terms of the flow and the appearance of a televised wrestling match, it never really felt like it was achieving that. And that always felt very important to me. Anyway. So this game has hints of that, and you look at it and go like, oh, okay, I see, like they're very deliberately trying to recreate or at least evoke the look and feel of those Aki N64 games. Which is, again, I think just strange. Anyway, the news this week is a little bit about that, but mostly about the roster. A story started going around, I guess, a couple of days ago now, that FTR, which is a tag team in a duo in AEW, is not going to appear in the game. They were at one point scheduled to appear in the game when they were recording audience chants for the game and all this other stuff. It seemed like they were in because they had people recording FTR chants and all of this other stuff. And so a lot of that stuff was in the works, and it sounds like that they have been cut. The roster has not been confirmed for that game. They've started to confirm a handful of wrestlers that will appear in the game. And I thought for a minute there, when this news first started hitting, I was like, well, shit, man, does that game even have tag team? It does have tag team matches in it, but I wonder if there's a certain element of, like, you know, AEW is focusing on tag team matches in a way that a lot of other organizations didn't, and they tried to make tag team matches feel special. And so you could see a situation where, like, hey, like some of these more dynamic tag team finishers and some of this other stuff is actually really hard to put in this game on the schedule we are trying to hit for our first gen product and all of this other stuff. And so it sounds like that might be the case. It sounds like the real story here is that the FTR, the two guys in the tag team, didn't find out that they were not in the game until some wrestling dirt sheet writer hit them up and said, hey, is this true? And then, so, you know, it sounds like there was maybe some communication problem there, which it sounds like a lot of the story around backstage AEW stuff these days is that communication is not what it needs to be. And they're presumably working on that by appointing new people into new positions and all this other shit. So to me, this just says that they are going to be DLC. You know, this is sort of like, if you've got work that's half done, and for whatever reason, you can't find a way to make it fit into the product, you're not going to throw that work away. So my understanding here is that this AEW game is not meant to be an annual product the way that the WWE games have become. And so it seems like something that would benefit from multiple years of DLC, of adding on characters, adding on match types, what, you know, like just various improvements along the way. And so, like, I don't know. I almost didn't talk about this because it just seems like the biggest non-story. But this to me just says, hey, that game's coming along. There's some stuff that they just don't have ready yet that, you know, if you think about the stuff that FTR does in the ring together as a tag team, whether it's their finishers and you know, or what have you, I think it would be difficult to get all that stuff in there and get it all feeling exactly right and proper and good along with everything else they have to build for this first year product. And so it seems very easy to me to look at it and go like, yeah, of course you're cutting out FTR. Like, of course you're not going to focus on tag team finishers and moves and all that other stuff. Like, you need to get the bones, you need to get the basics of that product right in a one-on-one situation. Like, on some level, I'm surprised it even fucking has tag team matches in it, but, you know, that would be an even weirder way to launch. So don't put FTR in it if you're not going to represent their move set properly, is what I say to it. AEW's tag teams do a lot of highly specific shit that if it's not represented in game, that'll be weird. And so it would be easy for me to see them maybe shying away from some tag teams. That said, I bet the Bucks are in there, right? I mean, they're senior vice presidents. So we'll see. We'll see how that all goes. But you're thinking about that game and coming, how that game must be coming together. Now it's finally, they're showing it in a playable state. They're claiming it's going to be out, what, like early next year or something like that. Like, what does that roster look like? They've brought in, you know, obviously CM Punk is on the cover and all that other stuff. And, you know, where are they putting their focus and all of that? I think it makes a ton of sense that a team like FTR, who has been with the company for a while, would not make the initial cut for that roster. But you would definitely want to put them in as soon as you could get them there. Especially if you already did a bunch of work to get them in the game. Because, again, you're not going to want to throw that work away. So this, again, it seems like a non-story because I think that you end up with FTR in that game, you know, as soon as they can get them there, just not at launch. And so you will pay money to play as Dax and Cash in AEW Fight Forever. Yes, and Cody Rhodes is in that game, even though he has left the company for WWE, which is ridiculous that he is in that game at all. But again, you did all that work. You have the rights. You have the contract signed. At some point, you might as well just put him in there. Now, obviously, the WWE games have fucking insane fucking broken rosters, like completely out of date rosters. If you already animated the Cody Vader, you might as well put it in game. But yeah. I don't know. I'm interested to see how that game comes together just by virtue of, like, it'll be nice to have a different, you know, much like AEW itself, it'll be nice to have an alternative wrestling game out there that feels like it has a budget, that feels like it is, you know, like trying to at least be a big deal, because obviously there are the other wrestling games out there on the market, whether it's a Fire Pro or a whatever M. Dickey is doing these days. It'll be nice to see it'll be interesting to see what Ukes really comes up with, because at the time I think that they said, oh, now we're going to make something that's unfettered by the annual bullshit schedule that we have been on, the absolute nightmarish grind we have been on making these fucking games for the last 20 years or whatever it was. But I don't know. We will see. Ukes has made some pretty bad games over the years. And I don't know. And then seeing all the mini games and, like, you can play this little baseball mini game. I'm like, okay, what about the fucking wrestling? Like, what about the goddamn wrestling? Like, you telling me you can't put FTR in the game, but you have time for this baseball thing? Like, that's weird too. But hey, different departments, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I just want a story creator. I just want to be able to see the future of the Ghost Problems story played out. So hopefully, you know, hopefully we'll eventually see something like that. I don't know. That's going to do it for news. Why don't we take a couple of emails here before we go? Podcast@guard.bike is the email address. That is where you want to send your emails. Let's go through this list here. We didn't get to any last week because the show was so weird with all the Gamescom announcements and all that sort of stuff. We are not going to get caught up this time either, but please keep sending in your emails, because every week I delete some that I originally thought about taking. Let's see here. Oh, man. Jeff from New York writes in. This is, it says, any hope for the new Saints Row will be good? That one maybe has outlived its usefulness. Let's see here. Philip asks, just wondering if you've gone back to the play date at all. I received mine the same week as the Steam Deck, and I've devoted most of my time to the deck. Don't get me wrong, I love the thing, but I hate not being able to play it in bed due to the lack of light. Playdate is a fascinating thing. I saw a screenshot. I don't know if this is a real thing or not, but it looked like a Playdate version of Cookie Clicker, where you could turn the crank to click cookies, which that's intriguing. No, and, you know, they did surveys. They sent out a survey to Playdate owners saying, what would you be looking for in a second season of Playdate games? And I honestly don't know what my answer. I answered those questions, but I think I wrote in like, I don't know. And they were open to everything, whether it was like, is it a, you know, do we do a second season? Do we open up a game store and sell games individually? Like what are the different ways? You know, it seems like they are looking at all possibilities when it comes to more games coming to the play date. And that seems smart. I don't know if another season of games that kind of release in the exact same cadence that the first season did makes a ton of sense. But I don't know what I would want out of more Playdate games. It's a cool device, and I think my problem with it ended up being that it's a really fun toy. And that's not a problem, I guess. It's kind of exactly what I was thinking I would get out of it. But like, none of the games really pulled me in and kept me there. You know, it was more like, oh, I got the new game. Let's check it out. Okay. All right. Yeah. That's neat. Let's see what the next one is. And so I just didn't feel like I wanted to stick with any of those games for a long period of time. It was some fun. Like, you know, it is kind of a gimmick, but it's a really good gimmick. And it's fun to see different game developers think of different ways to take advantage of the crank and the different hardware and all of that sort of stuff. And so when I think about what would I want out of a Playdate game, I guess it would be like more good games that would make me want to keep coming back. And I felt that the initial run of games on the Playdate, there were some good games in there, but nothing that made me feel like I can't wait to get back to the Playdate and do this and do this. You know, it just didn't work out for me that way. And I don't know what the actual answer to that question is, other than to say more better. I don't know. It's a cool device. It's a cool device, but I have not felt a huge draw to go back to the Playdate after experiencing all of the games and even installing some, like sideloading some other games and stuff like that. Elevator action where the crank moves the elevators, that they made. I mean, there is an elevator game on the Playdate where you do move elevators up and down and move people between floors with the crank. Like they straight up did that already. Emil from the Netherlands writes in and says, do you think the Game Boy brand will ever make a comeback? I've always preferred it over DS or Switch. I do not. I don't think that they, I mean, you know, unless they do, I guess they can't call it a Game Boy Micro. They already did that. But like, you know, could they do a Game Boy Mini that has like 20 games built in, or, you know, could they do some kind of like, here you go, it's a fake Game Boy that doesn't take cartridges, but we put 30 games on it. Maybe they could do something like that. I could see them doing something like that, but no, I don't see them returning to the Game Boy brand. Not because the Switch brand or the DS brand is incredibly strong. They did that, and they moved away from that, and I don't see any benefit to them moving back. Just doesn't seem like it would happen. Okay. Javin from Idaho. I guess it's one of those pronunciations. Video games and film are really meaningful parts of my life, but they're also hobbies that tend to demand a good chunk of time. If I wasn't into those things as passionately as I am, I could see myself totally loving D&D and collectible card games like Magic the Gathering. I have a lot of respect for those things and am at least aware of aspects of them in adjacent to what I enjoy in gaming, especially. My question is, if you weren't into video games as much as you are, what other hobbies or passions could you see yourself easily getting drawn into with similar fervor? We've got a raid from Abby. Hi, Abby, and Abby, and everyone from Abby's chat over there. We're doing emails. Hello, everyone. If you're not listening to this live, you're like, what the fuck are you talking about? But there you go. Hi, everyone. I like music. I am into music. I think music is good. That's a bold claim. I know. I think there's a lot. Also, I think there's a lot of bad music. But I like that there's a lot of bad music sometimes too. So yes, I think, you know, for me, it's video games and music. I think if I wasn't spending as much time on video games, what would I be into? I probably would have learned more Linux and probably would have learned more computer shit. And I'd probably be tinkering and building a NAS instead of, all that other stuff. But, you know, probably just, yeah, other dumb computer shit. But yeah, music is the big one for me. Maybe I would even still be making music, but I don't know. I sure do like listening to it. And I sure do feel like sometimes I don't have enough time to listen to it, but I have been listening to more music lately. It's been nice. A weird variety of. Like, I feel like my musical tastes over the last few years fucking blew out and got really strange. So, yeah, but that would probably be the easy one. I have an idea for a song I want to make. But I feel like I must write this song. I must write and record this song and put it on Spotify. I feel like it has to happen someday, but I don't know that, we'll see. We'll see when that happens. Let's take a couple more emails and then hit the bricks. Chris writes in and says, will we ever see a Steam subscription service? I just got a Steam Deck after a long time away from PC games. And the prospect of actually having to pay up front for games is kind of jarring after Xbox. Anything's possible. I think if Valve can find a way to make that make sense for them from a business perspective, maybe it would be something that they would do, but it's not something, I don't think it's a must from them. I don't think it's something that they definitely will do. I think it's something that is at best like possible. You're like, yeah, maybe Valve would do that, but, yeah, I don't know. You know, Valve has the Steam return policy, I think, ends up being really handy when it comes to trying out different games and finding ones that are for you and stuff. And so that ends up being kind of nice in some ways. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that Steam would end up doing one. I don't know that Valve would end up doing one themselves. But, you know, anything's possible. And, you know, yeah, eventually maybe more of the PC Game Pass kind of infrastructure runs on a Steam Deck more easily. I know some people, I have seen screenshots of people running the Xbox app on a Steam Deck, but I don't know if they have taken the dark step of installing Windows on a Steam Deck, which is, to me, that's, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. But yeah, I mean, the Steam sale is what they do. You know, you wait for their big seasonal sales and you buy all the back catalog stuff that you've been thinking about getting and all of that sort of stuff. Garrick writes in and says, Garrick from Grand Rapids again with a question about growing up in California. As a kid, 80s pop culture hammered California cool into my head 24/7. Everything from Kool-Aid flavors to cheap gas station sunglasses were dripping with California slang and imagery. Before grunge blew up, that idea of California was everything we wanted to be. What was it like on your end growing up so close to San Francisco? Did all that marketing seem like a lame-ass parody of California, or were you like, hell yeah, Mr. TV, California is awesome? Oh, I don't know. It just, I don't know. I don't think it ever really registered. To me, when you start getting into all of that fucking Ray-Bans, fucking Wayfarers, classic cars, fucking surfboard, cruising, hang loose shit, the more of that end of the California fucking thing you get into, the more it just starts to stink like a fucking Beach Boys reference to me. You know? Like, to me, it was ads for the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk on TV with fucking Beach Boys songs on TV being used as commercial. Like, my primary exposure to the Beach Boys catalog was fucking commercials, because it was and that sound, that fucking Beach Boys harmony and all the fucking Surfing USA and all that fucking shit that comes with the, like, it's California, like I think that stuff fucking sucks. I, you know, yeah, the Pet Sounds, you know, say what you will, like, okay, sure, fine, but all of their fucking, like, classic rock radio hits and all of that bullshit combined with the fucking color schemes and here's a palm tree and a pair of sunglasses next to it, like, I always just thought that stuff was super fucking corny. And so, like, having California marketed to you in a way that was, that felt like significantly less cool than the world around you, to me, it was more so. It's actually weird now that I'm now living in Southern California, but, like, the version of cool that was marketed to us was more of skateboarding culture and checkered vans. And that some of this is going to be time and age and all this sort of stuff too, right? And the fucking Legionnaire hats with that are also black and white checkerboard, just like the shoes, and SoCal skater culture, and like SoCal kind of, like, maybe a little bit later, was like the kind of laid back go-karts and miniature golf, and I always associated miniature golf with Southern California, because for the longest time there were no miniature golf courses near me, and so it was something that just felt more like an LA thing. And that always seemed like the cool you were chasing a little bit, was the Valley Girl mall culture cool. Which is in some ways the same stuff that you were getting, but, like, Northern California and Southern California are very different things. Incredibly different things. So for me, it was more like there was some variant of that that was like, oh, Southern California seems really fucking cool. And you'd watch movies like Midnight Madness and be like, oh man, look at all that cool shit. They're going to arcades. And there's miniature golf and go-karts. And so I think we got the same stuff, just slightly different. Other than that, or it was just those fucking California Raisins commercials, and you're like, oh god, kill me. Just kill me. Let's see here. Let's make this the last email from Anthony. What, if any, future collaborations would you like to see in Rumbleverse? Do you think we will ever see any AEW or WWE skins or items in the game? Having a Kenny Omega One Winged Angel skin, or like a goodbye and goodnight taunt, or like a John Cena You Can't See Me taunt while wearing John Cena gear head to toe would be pretty rad. I would love to run around in duos as Demolition or the Young Bucks. So when I first heard about this project, when I first heard, and before I had seen anything about the graphical style, before I had seen anything about the way the game was going to look or anything like that, in my head, I literally pictured Kenny Omega running around a city And like what that looked like. I think the visual style of the game is such that it's so over the top that I think putting real humans into it fully as like, here's literally, you are buying a full on Kenny Omega skin. I would be interested to see how they would implement that given the kind of exaggerated body styles of that game. But of course you could certainly taunts like different things that are either evoke those things or are licensed directly. You could certainly do that. I don't know, but having a real looking character model, an accurate looking character model in that game next to the exaggerated styles would be jarring. You know, I think it would look really weird. You know, if you put like Fortnite John Cena into Rumbleverse, that doesn't make sense. And so you could do an exaggerated bigger John Cena and you could do that sort of stuff, but like, you know, which they've done with those characters before in various games, All-Stars and some of the other stuff they've done over the years. Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a ton of room, obviously, for merchandise. And you know, I think it's an interesting clash of desires, right? Because the model for that game, the model for Fortnite and all of that sort of stuff is very much about you purchasing cosmetics. And so the way Fortnite has done licensed stuff has been incredibly on brand, where like, this is Goku. This is not exaggerated Rumbleverse style Goku. This is not exaggerated Fortnite style Goku. It's motherfucking Goku. It's on licensed, on brand Goku. This is on licensed, on brand John Cena and Ryu and all that sort of stuff. Ryu looks a little weird, actually. But so, you know, would you go and make exaggerated Rumbleverse style John Cena? Would that be the thing that makes sense? Would you go and make, you know, what would the Kenny Omega model look like compared to the other characters in that game, and how would you make that look good and all of that sort of stuff? And so would you just do gear? Would you just do even finishers? Or would you say, actually, what people want is the full experience? And so not only do we have to do, you know, the one wicked angel as an alternate finisher, we also need to do a full-on Kenny Omega, you know, and do you do those in pieces? Can I take the Kenny Omega hair and put it on any of the other character models? Or is it just full-on, here's Kenny Omega, and you can't go take his jacket and put it on the other guys? Like, I think that there's just a lot of... I don't know how they would do it. I that seems like something that I bet they have an answer to that question. I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is with that sort of stuff, you know. Sandwich Jones in the chat says they took out the fucked up thumbs up emote. They did. The I don't know if you, the animated GIF of the referee from one of the WWE games doing a fucking weird broken thumbs up behind his back and a weird broken rubber armed model. They made that as an emote in Rumbleverse, and it was in the betas, and it's not in the game currently, which to me says, and again, savvy business, you want that awesome fucking wraparound thumbs up? Buy the battle pass. Not this season, but that has to be in the game eventually, right? I mean, you know, every time they did the beta, they changed up which cosmetics were in the game. And so, my guess is that you will eventually see that in there in some way, shape, or form. But yes, this is something I've spent already too much time thinking about, as like, man, how would you implement? Because the expectation from a wrestling game is you want to be able to create a wrestler, whether you're making someone who looks like yourself or whether you are making someone who looks like a wrestler that is not in the game. Like, wrestling games have character creators, and you can go and create your fake CM Punk and put him in the WWE game and so on and so forth. Obviously this is a very different thing and a very different business model. So, you know, how does that stuff work? Yeah. There's some examples of, like, you know, they kind of put the New Day, that, you know, into Fall Guys and some other stuff like Brawlhalla. So you have different examples of like different art styles and in different games and stuff like that. So we'll see. I guess the other example is, like, do any of those brands and characters want to be affiliated with a wrestling adjacent game when they themselves are trying to sell wrestling games? Would the answer to that be like, oh, that's fun, but like, hey, you can put John Cena in Fortnite, but you absolutely cannot put him in this wrestling game because he's in this other wrestling game that we sell. And so I wonder, you know, if that would be a bumpy road there, just from licensing and how that stuff would even work. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is, but yes, I have to get in touch with one Dave Lang, and get him on the show here now that the game is out, and hopefully they all have a little bit more free time now that the game is shipped. I want to get him on and chop it up with him about all kinds of shit. So, yeah, maybe we will ask him some of those questions and see what he has to say about that sort of stuff. I don't know. Anyway, that's going to do it for the show. I hope everybody is having an awesome Tuesday. My schedule, I had a very different schedule in mind for this week, and it is in the process of changing as we speak because of the housework getting done in a different schedule and all of that sort of stuff. So stuff's a little bit all over the place, but you will see me again this week. I'll probably be with you on Friday, and then I probably will be with you again tomorrow on Wednesday as well, but I gotta figure some other stuff out, because originally this work was gonna take 2 days and now it might only be taking one. Anyway, I gotta get these headphones off and see what's going on out in the other room and see how stuff is going and see how that's going to impact my stream schedule for the rest of the week. But everybody have a good rest of your week, and I will see you again soon. I will post on Twitter and so on and so forth when I know, you'll know. Have a good rest of your week, everybody. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Jeff Gerstmann Show. In the meantime, keep it. I don't have a good send off kind of slogan. Like, keep it greasy. No, I don't. That's not a good one. That's not a good one at all. Next episode of Game Boys to Men is recorded. I got to do some light edits to it, and then it'll be out there for people to check out on patreon.com/Jeff Gerstmann. Head on over there to enjoyyourgaming.com. That redirects to the Patreon. Dopeassvideogames.com, that redirects to the Patreon. Head on over there. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's where that long-ass Saints Row video is, if you want to see some of that. If you want to see some Pac-Man World repack, that's up over there too. There's some other archives that I have not had time to process and upload yet, so there's a couple of other games I got to turn around and post. So we'll do that. And I'll see you soon. Bye, everybody.